This is Richard Perrone, and I'm doing an oral history interview with Mr. Anthony Bora. Today is March 25th, 2003. The time is 8:50 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, at the Special Collections Library interview room, and Mr. Bora is in Stone Mountain, Georgia. Sir, let's start with some biographical information on yourself, if we could. Tell me a little bit about your childhood, where you were born, when you were born, and kind of where you grew up.
Born and raised in New York City, Queens in particular, specifics. 1940, August of 1940, and spent my entire childhood through college in essentially the same area of Queens near the 59th Street Bridge.
Really? Okay. So you're a native New Yorker?
Yes.
Okay. How many brothers and sisters did you have?
I have one younger sister. She's 5 years younger than me.
Okay. And what did your parents do?
Dad was blue collar. Both of my parents. My father was born in Italy and came to this country as a young child. My mother was first generation born in the United States, also essentially of Italian parentage. They grew up in Manhattan in the essentially Italian ghettos. Dad worked. Neither of them finished high school, and Dad worked. For most of my childhood, Dad worked for a manufacturing company, and mother often worked outside the house in order to supplement Dad's income.
Okay. Okay. Did they value? Did they push you into schooling, making sure that you were in school and emphasizing education to you?
Yes, and I was just talking with my son about that recently. That they wanted my life to be better than theirs, as was typical of that generation. Probably typical of most generations, but I think it's harder these days. But because they had not completed much schooling, they certainly encouraged education, and I think if they were, they would have been happy if I had just vocational training, just as long as I had skills. I did well in school and was able to do more than that, but and the New York City school system offered lots of opportunity down many paths, both vocationally and towards higher education.
What kind of student were you?
I always had an interest in engineering. I liked working with my hands, and I had a an interest in visual art, and that seemed to work as a, both work well as a supplement to engineering students. I was in a small, very small grammar school, which is hard to understand in New York City, but there were only four classes in a grade. So when I graduated, there were three, my class and three others graduating at the same time. And they were not large classes, probably less than 30 students. And New York City has a number of particularly good high schools that you can compete for scholastically. They have entrance exams, and they look at school records. And I was able to, I gained admission to Brooklyn Technical High School, which was an engineering college preparatory school.
Where did your interest in working with your hands and the, you know, the engineering bent to your intellectual activity, where did that come from?
I think mostly my grandfather and some of my uncles, because my dad, that was not my dad's forte. And I always had an interest in model airplanes and in high school model rocketry, and it evolved. But my uncles, and one uncle in particular, and my grandfather were always building something or repairing something, and and I just always enjoyed that same activity with them.
Okay. Did you guys speak Italian in your home?
No, we did not. My dad was insistent on being immersed in the American culture, and so actually he forbade that. And
he forbade, really?
And he was he was chastised by my high school teachers for not affording me the opportunity for language exposure, but they never spoke Italian in the house. My grandparents and my mother would speak with them, and sometimes her siblings, but never to the children. So I never heard any Italian other than probably no more than any of my Irish friends.
Now, did your grandparents come over later from Italy?
No, on my mother's side, my grandfather came from Italy as a teenager on his own to make his way in America. And as he worked, and they, of course, like so many of the immigrants, worked very hard and diligently, as many Mexican-Americans do, Mexican immigrants do today, sending money back home and eventually bringing his parents and his, I guess he brought his brothers first, and then they eventually brought the parents. My father's mother left with him as a child. He was about 3 years old. And she just came to the America to make a new life for herself. And, and she remarried eventually in New York also.
Okay. What was it like in Queens growing up? Tell me about that.
Well, it was an ethnic neighborhood, but it was a mix. It was it was all families, a lot of all multi-family housing, but like the house I grew up in, which was actually my grandparents, my grandfather, although he never had education, he was successful in a blue-collar way, so he bought a home. We lived in one of the, it was a three-family home, and we lived in one of the apartments. And that was typical of all my friends. There were some, you know, six and maybe a dozen or more families in some of the larger buildings, but most of them were homes that were just multi-story, not untypical of New York. There weren't many single-family residents. There were some, but and we were a mix of Italian, Irish, German, smattering of Polish, and so that group was all Christian, mostly Catholic, and then we had Jewish families in the same, mixed in the same neighborhood. Many of the merchants were Jewish, but not all. Many were the other ethnic groups. And then we had a small number of Oriental families. And later we had some influx of Puerto Rican immigrants started coming to New York City.
Wow, a true melting pot, it sounds like.
Yeah, it really was. And yet this was in a wouldn't qualify as suburban in the type of environment we mostly live in now, but it would have been essentially a suburb, because it wasn't Manhattan, and this was almost all residential and small retail, a small, some construction businesses and, you know, some small manufacturing, and that's what my father was in.
Okay. Did you associate with all these groups, like when you were, you know, on the streets playing with the kids?
Oh, absolutely.
And everything?
Yeah, you always played on the street for the most part. I'll mm-hmm. tell you a little bit. I had an exception to that, but we mostly played on the street. We played stickball and games like stoop ball, and
mm-hmm.
we roller skated in the street and played softball up at it's called Sandlot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But none of it was organized.
Right.
I never played any organized sports, except in high school. But that was all intramural.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not varsity.
Mm-hmm. Did you follow like the Yankees or the Mets or the Giants?
I was never a sports fan.
Really?
And I always was a token Yankees fan because they were winners, I guess.
Uh-huh.
But I never really had. I mean, some of my friends were passionate.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, baseball card trading. I mean, during the Korean War, I collected trading cards, but they were all of Air Force airplanes.
Okay.
That sort of thing. My grandfather, being Italian, mm-hmm. most of the Italians were avid gardeners,
mm-hmm.
and we always, even though we were in Queens, we had a area behind our house that was fenced and ours, and Granddad had built what we used to call a shack. It was like a tool shed
mm-hmm.
that eventually became my hobby shop and my hobby center.
Mm-hmm.
And I built my model airplanes out there, and he
okay.
built himself a new building. But I always had a place off the street to play, and that was really, for me, you know, auspicious, I think, because it led to my hobby pursuits.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, tell me, did you any of your family members serve in World War I, World War II?
I had my grandfather's brother, so that would be like a great uncle,
mm-hmm.
Served in World War I, and
okay.
he, in fact, had been in one of the caught in one of the gas attacks, and he had lingering respiratory problems, especially as he got older, that
mm-hmm.
bothered him. My favorite uncle, who also was the one that worked like my grandfather
mm-hmm.
with his hands and crafted a lot
mm-hmm.
of projects, he served in World War II and in Italy. And he was at the landings at Salerno, he had some evidently harrowing ordeals,
mm-hmm.
and seeing my mother and her sisters always exclaimed that he was never the same when he came back from the war.
Really?
And I don't know that. Uncle, his name was Joe,
mm-hmm.
and I call him Uncle Joey.
Mm-hmm.
Uncle Joey was a wonderful man, and he had his withdrawn moments. And, I only later, as an adult, can I reflect back on that, think of
mm-hmm.
what perhaps demons for him ran through his mind.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever talk to him later?
He rarely, and I just talked to one of his brothers, another. Sort of favorite uncle,
mm-hmm.
The only one surviving, in fact, who said that he and they were close brothers. That Joey never much talked about the war. Occasionally, at a wedding or something, after he had a few libations,
mm-hmm.
he might reminisce on some of the fun parts,
mm-hmm.
you know, like being a soldier liberating a town and
mm-hmm.
the warm reception he got from the Italians. So,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But only on things like that.
Okay. Where did your love for model airplanes and flying come from?
Yeah, I don't know. I really don't. I've thought about that
mm-hmm.
because my son has asked. I really don't know. I just was always fascinated by airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And Dad was good. He'd either take me sometimes after work, he'd take me to the, we had large railroad switching yards in Queens, and we'd go and stand on a, like a viaduct that ran over the yard, and watch the trains. And I was, I just was always taken with machinery, and my uncles seemed to, they had a demonstrated love of automobiles, and, and I, you know, I like bicycles, and I just like mechanical things, and airplanes seemed to be the, you know, the ultimate mechanical thing. And when I went to high school, I was able to actually pick a major, and I chose aeronautical engineering. And, so that, you know, that just sort of reinforced that.
How was high school for you? What do you remember about that?
Just a wonderfully innocent time. I always enjoyed, I still enjoy learning. And high school, Brooklyn Tech was a challenging school, and you could do a lot there. And we had workshops that during World War II, as I understand, and maybe even, I don't know about Korea, they made components there for the Northern bomb site. And we had a complete foundry in the school. I mean, that's really, think about it. Yeah, we had an electric furnace. We did pattern making and mold making. The school emphasized the practical side of engineering and the theoretical. So we did, and it's still a school of reputation, with I think today great emphasis on, you know, the information technologies and science. But, you know, we studied aeronautical theory in class, but then we also went to a shop where we disassembled, I remember disassembling a Ranger six-cylinder engine, which was used pre-World War II, and I guess maybe in the early war in a trainer aircraft. But we had machine shops, and you, as a student, got to operate equipment in there, including lathes and milling machines and so forth. And we did sheet metal, and, you know, and then we did the physics labs and the chemistry labs. And so it was a really well-rounded school with a big emphasis on sports. And again, I was a non-sports person, but you had to participate in what we called gym, and there was big emphasis on the competitive sports like the horse and the parallel bars and the high bar, and you just did all of those. And so, I mean, their objective was to prepare you for college and with a well-rounded experience.
Sounds like you certainly had that.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And, and you know, my recollection is wonderful, wonderful staff of teachers, very very proud of their students, and very supportive and dedicated. They're a really great bunch.
What do you remember about the Korean War? What are your memories of that?
You know, I don't remember much. I had one, you know, when I was a young teenager, I had a young girl my age who I had a crush on, as you would say these days. Well, back then we said it was a crush. I don't know what you call it.
I think it's called the same thing. I'm not sure.
But her brother was a B-29 tail gunner. And so I remember, you know, I didn't know many that had, other than he, that were in the war. And, of course, we always held him, you know, in some high place, both in our hearts and our imagination, young airman. And I collected the trading cards, and, you know, and I remember just always perusing, looking for stories about the dogfights, because that that was the, you know, both the aviation interest on my part, and also it got a lot of press.
Right, right. This is, you were in high school in the late 50s, is that right?
I was in high school from 54 to 58.
Okay. And when you graduated in 58, did you have your sights set on going to college or what?
Yes, yeah. I mean, at Brooklyn Tech, as we call it, everybody went on. I mean, most of everybody. I don't know what the percentage was, but it seemed mm-hmm. like most everybody went on to college. And mm-hmm. Tech graduates have achieved a lot in the world
mm-hmm.
as far as I can keep up with the alumni news. It's a school that just was inspiring. I mean, mm-hmm. it really is interesting. But you know, and it was an all boys school back then.
Okay. Let me ask you a couple questions about some other general things. Tell me what it was like to grow up Italian American. There's been a lot of study about obviously growing up, different ethnic groups coming over to the United States, mm-hmm. making a way for themselves, like your right. grandparents and parents did. What was it like to grow up Italian American?
Very very patriotic.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of emphasis, family. We held on to a lot of tradition. So holiday meals were always taken in community.
Mm-hmm.
We spent time as an extended family all the time.
Really?
So different from the life I live now in the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
So you had your apartment, but even those of the siblings who didn't live in the house, so my grandparents lived there, we lived there,
mm-hmm.
and eventually one of the aunt and her family lived on the third apartment. For a while, it was rented to a Greek family. That
mm-hmm.
was the other group that was there, the Greeks.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But every night, it seemed like if the weather was decent,
mm-hmm.
we always visited on the what's called the stoop, which is
mm-hmm.
the steps of the house,
mm-hmm.
and on we had a small, very small little patio area, even though it was right off the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
And neighbors had come by, and you knew, of course, you never could do anything, as I always remind my son.
Mm-hmm.
Some neighbor was always watching you and threatening to tell your parents if you did anything. So, you know, you had aunts and uncles, and then you had all your friends' parents. And
mm-hmm.
So people just visited. I mean,
mm-hmm.
the street was a just an active neighborhood, and all the shopkeepers, everybody was there forever, it seemed like,
mm-hmm.
until my generation grew up and we all moved away.
Mm-hmm.
And so you if you went to any retail establishment, you knew the owner, you knew the people that worked there, they knew you were forever being greeted or
mm-hmm.
called after by someone.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very embracing community.
It sounds like it. Sounds like it. Have you seen the movie A Bronx Tale?
No.
Okay. I was just asking because that it's a De Niro film, and he actually directed that. And
he would have insight.
Mm-hmm. You're describing, I'm picturing street scenes from this where the kids would, go around and all the adults knew them and all the shopkeepers knew who everybody was, and it seemed like a kind of a large block family almost.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. It's called A Bronx Film?
A Bronx Tale.
A Bronx Tale.
A Bronx Tale, yes, sir.
I'll look for that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
It's quite a good movie. But moving on with your stuff.
I could talk about that nostalgically. Now I understand why old people never shut up.
Well, I could actually, as an Italian-American myself, I could talk to you about that a lot, but we can move on. Tell me about your decision to go to college and how that happened.
Well, it was never a conscious decision.
Uh-huh.
It was just that's what everybody did. I mean, all your teachers, they never asked you if you're going to college. They just always
mm-hmm.
talked to you
mm-hmm.
as though you were going to college. And the big question was where.
Mm-hmm.
And my fond hope, and this is the first time in my life that I faced failures, not really appropriate, but I didn't achieve my objective.
Mm-hmm.
Because I applied to Cornell University,
okay.
was accepted, which was, I mean, I
wow.
can still remember that day, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, so elated. And everything hinged on getting a Naval ROTC scholarship, which was one of the few scholarships other than something probably like national merit. And
mm-hmm.
although I was a good student, I didn't have an expectation that I would be at that level,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't get a national scholarship. And I passed the academic hurdles that the exams and so forth,
mm-hmm.
and the whatever documents you had to submit for the Navy scholarship. And so I was really riding on a high horse at that point. And then I had to go take the physical, and I didn't pass the eye exam.
Oh,
and
really?
I was just, I can still remember the tears just welling up my eyes. I just couldn't believe that,
mm-hmm.
you know, there was anything that was going to prevent that.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, so I did not get to attend Cornell because it was just too expensive a school, and it was a
mm-hmm.
five-year curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
And I did get a scholarship to a smaller school called Manhattan College
mm-hmm.
New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And so I studied engineering there, and they didn't offer aeronautical, and so I went with mechanical.
Okay.
I mean, everybody just expected you were going to go on to college, and, you know, so you just applied and did.
Mm-hmm. Were you the first in your family to go to college?
Yes.
Okay.
He's a cousin
mm-hmm.
who's older than I am,
mm-hmm.
who actually attended New York. It's not New York University in the city, but it's
mm-hmm.
the New York University in upstate, and he became a school teacher.
Okay.
So I was one of two who
mm-hmm.
went to college.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you join ROTC at Manhattan?
Mm-hmm. And you know, I didn't have any expectation.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Civil Air Patrol when I was in high school, and I liked that. And,
What was that? What did you do there?
Not much, unfortunately, because we were, you know, we got one airplane ride, and,
mm-hmm.
and it was not a good experience. It seemed like the adults that were there were frustrated because they hadn't been in the military
mm-hmm.
or hadn't been able to be in the military,
mm-hmm.
and so they seemed to take pleasure in lording over kids, and we picked up on that pretty quick, and eventually I quit because I just didn't. We were doing busy stuff. We weren't really doing aviation stuff,
mm-hmm.
and I was disappointed. So I quit that. And then when I in the summer, just before the start of college, I received a postcard in the mail that said, "Do you want to go to gym or do you want to go to ROTC?" And I had had enough of gym.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I thought, ROTC, what the heck, I'll give
mm-hmm.
that a try.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't expect to really fly, and the brochure they sent, you know, talked about the possibility of doing engineering work in the Air Force, and then that all of a sudden that started to become interesting,
mm-hmm.
and or interest me, and so I pursued ROTC, and I'll tell you how I got into aviation later.
Okay. What kind of student were you academically?
Well, I started out having too good a time and
mm-hmm.
had to go talk with the dean, and
mm-hmm.
he got my attention. And by junior and senior year, I was back to about a 3.0.
Okay. Well, I want to ask about joining the Air Force ROTC versus
yeah.
the other branches.
They only offered Air Force at Manhattan, which
really?
Was fortunate for me.
Okay.
Yeah. I think I wanted to be a Marine at one point when I was a younger
uh-huh.
student, and I had a neighbor who had been a Marine, and he said, "There's only well, you know." And I have great admiration for Marines,
mm-hmm.
but he told me that you have to be half crazy to be a Marine. You go to the Air Force or the Navy, and
uh-huh.
he's said, stay away from the army. So, and, you know, he was somebody that I had great respect for.
Mm-hmm.
He was older than I. He was the son of a German immigrant,
mm-hmm.
and I really loved his parents, so I had, you know, I respected him.
Okay. So you joined up the Air Force
ROTC.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Tell me what that experience was like for you.
Well, it was sort of disappointing in freshman and sophomore year because the emphasis was on drill,
mm-hmm.
you know, just marching and marching and marching. And
mm-hmm.
I didn't understand, you know, we did some air power history, but I don't know, it wasn't a particularly airplane oriented, and I was disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
But we had good staff, and almost all of the folks were veterans,
mm-hmm.
and the colonel in charge and the lieutenant, I think he had a lieutenant colonel on the staff, they were really decorated guys, and I really came to understand what they had done.
Mm-hmm.
And
did they talk to you about their experiences?
Well, the lieutenant colonel, he may have been a major, but I think he was an LC. He had actually joined. I was just talking to my father-in-law about this yesterday. It's
mm-hmm.
funny. Who's a World War II B-26 pilot.
Mm-hmm.
The major or lieutenant colonel, he couldn't. He was too young to join the United States Air Force or the U.S. Army Air Corps at that time,
mm-hmm.
And so he went to Canada. And he became, flight trained, and I assume got a commission. I don't know. They may have had flying sergeants back then.
Mm-hmm.
And he flew in Europe with Canadian uniform and wings.
Wow.
Until the United States entered the war. That was the other thing. I guess we weren't in the war
mm-hmm.
initially.
Mm-hmm.
So he went early on. That maybe it wasn't his age. It was just that he wanted to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the United States joined the war, he wore both Canadian wings and U.S. Air Force wings.
Mm.
And I was always, you know, really struck by that.
Mm-hmm.
And he was he just had a he carried himself with a bearing that, you know, it just sort of called for your attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so we liked him a lot. He was a real, he was an inspiring guy.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like you played a role in your,
your
life there.
Yeah, it did. And both he and the colonel went to graduate school at night, and that was also impressive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were both they had finished their formal education, and then here they were, you know, taking graduate course.
Right.
And they both got a graduate degree before they left the school.
Hmm.
So that was also, you know, sort of a very positive role model.
Mm-hmm. Did you do your basic training during one of those summers?
Yes, we did. You know, the program is probably different now, but
mm-hmm.
what we did was you got commissioned right out of college,
mm-hmm.
and the only requirement was that you did I think it was 4 weeks, and maybe it was only three, I don't recall now. You went to summer camp I don't remember now, whether it was between sophomore and junior year or junior and senior year,
mm-hmm.
A group of us went to Lockbourne Air Force Base,
okay,
which is now, I think, named after Grissom. I think it's Grissom Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's been renamed.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and that was more of, we did survival training, and that was fun and challenging.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a basic introduction, and we got we were given some flights on they had tankers there, and we
mm-hmm.
said we got to fly on the tankers and
mm-hmm.
refuel B-52s and. You know, that was neat.
Yeah.
And I think we got a T-33 trainer ride.
Mm-hmm.
And I was hooked.
Tell me about the first time you ever flew. I mean, I assume this was when you were younger, much younger.
Well, the first time I flew was after I was commissioned.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I don't know. I never thought to do that in New York City. I don't know why. You know, the kids that were in ROTC and destined for pilot training
mm-hmm.
got to go to a flight school. I mean, I didn't have much money. My parents didn't have much money, and I always worked, but it was to pay my school bills and other expenses. And, you know, I mean, that's probably an excuse because I really, really, really wanted to fly. I'm sure I could have somehow, but I didn't.
What kind of jobs did you work?
Just grocery store clerk and, you know, supermarket checking.
Mm-hmm.
During the summers, I was lucky. I had two summers I worked for Grumman Aircraft in just in production. It was sort of like to, if you were an engineering student, they wanted you to, you know, have some production experience. Those were really wonderful jobs. And the other jobs were, I worked for a company as a draftsman. They designed aircraft fluid measuring systems, so like, you know, fuel quantity or oil quantity, and I got to work in the drafting room, and it was, you know, somewhat interesting. It would have been more interesting to work, you know, say in production or, or the lab. So they were just mostly jobs to help pay school bills and, you know, just contribute to the family.
Right.
But they weren't, other than the Grumman jobs, they were not necessarily career related. Oh, you know, the working for the company called Liquidometa was somewhat. So where were we going? I got lost here.
Well, tell me how your parents felt about you being in the military.
No, I'm sorry. You asked me about flying.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So when I was in, after I got commissioned, I was at Keesler Air Force Base because I got commissioned and assigned a Air Force specialty code, AFSC, as a communications maintenance officer.
Okay. This is in 62?
62.
Okay.
So I was at Keesler, which, you know, that was an interesting experience going from New York City to Biloxi, Mississippi.
I can imagine.
In 1962.
I can totally imagine.
Yeah, the first thing I read was the book Black Like Me to try to understand what was, you know, what I was seeing. And, you know,
wow. Did you read that on your own volition? Did you?
Yeah, I did. Well, you know, I always had an issue with my dad, who had some demonstrate prejudice towards Jews and blacks, and I didn't understand that because as I used just, you know, sometimes I had some pretty hot conversation with my dad about, you know, you came over from the old country and you know what it was like to be called a Dago and a WOP. How could you feel, you know, prejudice towards others? And and we never, that never got resolved, so to speak. But I didn't understand why that was so. I mean, that's just something. I don't know where that came from. And I always had, you know, I always had contact with others, other groups. I didn't have many black or colored friends, as we called them back then. I had some in school, but not many. And, you know, when I think back, even then, we sort of lived in separate neighborhoods, but we mingled much more like I do now than that sort of really awkward period we went through during. As I experienced when I was in the South, but I was not unaware that there was racial prejudice and. I don't know how we got here from flying again, but going to Biloxi, Mississippi. Okay, so that was, you know, that was just a shocking eye opener.
What do you remember? What did you see down there?
Well, of course, I really was struck by the segregated facilities. I mean, to go into a Sears Roebuck and see a colored water fountain, to see two benches on the street, one for colored and one for white for the bus. To see a separate side entrance at the movie theater for colored. And when I was in Biloxi, you know, the only time you saw a person of color was if they were the yard person. And I lived in a duplex off base. I was married.
Okay.
And the folks that owned the house lived on the other side, and Doc and Betsy Sellers, and they had a handyman that came, and an older black gentleman,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and they used to, they went to pain to and length to try to impress on us that they didn't think any less of, and I forget the gentleman's name, Mr. So-and-so, because they used to even let him eat with them. Of course, he had to sit at a stool and eat at the sink, and they ate at the table.
Hmm.
And he had a special glass, and that was kept separate from, you know, everything else, I guess, with the china, too.
Hmm.
And you know, it just, all that just struck my young mind.
Mm-hmm.
I was fairly idealistic, I guess, and I still am. It just, you know, struck me as just, you know, how could they say one thing and then not see what they were doing?
Right.
And then just to, you know, see the overt racism, and then as I reflected, I realized how much of it had been there in New York City, but it had been covert, if or you know,
mm-hmm.
Not talked about.
Right.
One of my mother's sisters was married to an American Jew,
mm-hmm.
and so, you know, the family had to dance around that.
Mm-hmm.
I know that was a source, that was an issue at times.
Mm-hmm.
And my cousin, their son, who I grew up with, Ronnie, eventually married into the Jewish community, and
mm-hmm.
is Jewish now by religion,
mm-hmm.
His choice, and we always had to dance around that. But Ronnie and I, you know, were fine. I
mm-hmm.
mean, I didn't know Ronnie any different because he was Jewish, and
mm-hmm.
and the school that I went to, it seemed that we always had a large number of Jewish students who were very, very good students,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and that's how I knew them. And one of my best, and I really mean this, one of my good friends in high school was Chinese, Ray Chen,
mm-hmm.
and so I, you know, you just, it was more of a, you had more interaction with people,
mm-hmm.
and you know, Ray and I used to swap lunches sometimes, so he could eat what my mother sent, and
mm-hmm.
I'd eat what his mother sent. And,
mm-hmm.
He'd always do that when she sent a sandwich that had lots of that hot Chinese mustard in it. So
when you're down in Biloxi,
yeah.
did you brought this
your
experiences with you, and it was a very different world. Did you what did it make you feel about the United States in general?
Hmm. That's a good question.
Such diverse
things. It was embarrassing. I know I felt that.
Mm-hmm. Were there any black people in your unit?
Oh no, hell no.
Okay. Okay.
No, I don't recall. If, you know, I never saw a commissioned another lieutenant black.
Mm-hmm.
Until I got to the radar site in California where I first was stationed.
Okay.
I can tell you about that later, but
mm-hmm.
I remember it was real obvious how uncomfortable he was.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
You felt embarrassed, you said.
Yeah, embarrassed, and confused.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, embarrassed and confused, I think, would be appropriate words.
Okay. Do you think that people today have a sense of the diverse culture that the United States had back then in the 50s and 60s during the time of segregation?
Mm. You know, I look at my own son. His mother is Greek-American.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Italian-American. His wife is essentially German American.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Tony's our son is law enforcement,
mm-hmm.
and I think Tony's aware of the race issue only. I don't know that he ever thinks of people by any ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think all of his friends were all of mixed lineage. And while we try to hold on to some traditions without the bigger family around, he doesn't do much of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he's just immersed in Americana.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, there he in law enforcement, he's in an area. He's in an area of Florida where there's still a lot of racial prejudice, and there's not a in his community, which is St. Augustine, Florida. There's not a an evident black middle class as there is here in Stone Mountain. I mean, we live in an upper middle class, racially integrated neighborhood, and we, you know, we dine in our neighbors' homes, and we party together, and we go out together.
Mm-hmm.
And Tony comes here, and he's always amazed at that. You know, he comes to a dinner party here, and we may be, along with him and his wife, the only white people there, or and these are all our neighbors are all professionals.
Mm-hmm.
And so for him, it's when he comes here, it's that experience. And when he goes back to St. Augustine, all he sees, unfortunately, in the black community is poverty. And
right.
The drug use is in the community as a whole, but it also, he tends to, no, no, he tends to see it in the black community, even though, because, I don't know why that is, you know, but his view is, he struggles with that, I think. So, he doesn't see ethnicity, but I think he does see racial difference.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that you had an advantage coming from New York City, such a diverse populace, and then going down to the South and having to adapt to their ways?
You know, I think I did, but I don't know that all of my friends did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in some of the Italian American families, there was terrible racial prejudice and ethnic prejudice. There was lots of, you know, some of my friends' parents didn't like Germans. Mm-hmm. That, you know, they had all those awful slur names that they had for each group. You know, there were Dagos and Wops, and there were Kikes, and there were Chinks, and I mean, you know, all those awful words that people threw around. And you know, the Irish always were considered to be drunkards, and you know, I didn't see it that way, but I can only speak for myself. I think some of my friends carried off some of those prejudices, and others, like myself, didn't. You know, and I don't know. I mean, we could have a whole oral history about why people feel those jealousies.
Yes.
Is
yes.
What I see them as. I don't know why people feel embittered towards people they don't even know. But
it sounds like it's kind of personality driven.
Somehow, yeah.
How did your parents feel about you being in the military?
Oh, they were extremely proud. Extremely proud.
Okay.
We never finished up how I got flying lift.
Exactly. Well, let's finish that. Go ahead.
So when I was at Biloxi, they had an aero club, like they do in most Air Force bases.
Uh-huh.
And for, heck, it was like $5 a ride.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, you paid the instructor and maybe another $5. Well, I, for the first time, I had a little bit of extra money, and I was getting per diem down there to live off base. And so I took flying lessons from an old guy who had an Italian name, and I think he was, you know, there were a lot of Italian Americans that lived in New Orleans. Anyway, his name was Antonio Grande.
Okay.
And it so happens that we have family connection to the Grandes. And so, I mean, not that really mattered. But I wound up taking lessons with him, and he was just a wonderful, charming old guy. And so I took lessons all through solo and cross-country, almost up to the point of getting my license.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had to, then I finished up my schooling, and I had to go to my duty assignment.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at a radar site. And we didn't have an aero club at a radar site.
Right.
And so I never got to finish up, and then I just put that aside and got involved in other things.
Okay.
Until I applied for and accepted to pilot training.
Okay.
Now, I'm sorry.
No. Well, tell me about your training there at Keesler. What, you're a communications maintenance officer. Is that correct?
Back then, there weren't any computers. There certainly wasn't any wireless.
Mm-hmm.
There was barely, we didn't even have fax. That was something that was coming, a marvel on the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
So we had teletype. We had still had switchboards at the radar site. We had we were just going to automated switching, so they were still using operators and pulling cords and plugging them in, and we were just getting into the transistor age, and so we studied. The Air Force takes square pegs and beats them until they fit in round holes.
Mm-hmm.
So I was supposed to be a mechanical engineer, and here I was learning about electronic technology, which was fine.
Okay.
And we learned about, Air Force communication networks, radio and landline, and telephones, which were, of course, all mechanical back then.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that we learned much management theory. It was mostly to give us background in the equipment we would see in the field, all the AN equipment, and I assume that's Army, Navy, I don't know, it's World War II designations, and all the equipment was still painted brown, and so we learned just some general introduction to the equipment itself.
Okay. How long did that training last in Biloxi?
Essentially 3 months.
Okay. Okay. And from there, you said you went to California to a radar
site?
Right.
I was assigned to a radar site on the Santa Cruz mountain range.
Okay. Was this in 62 as well?
Yeah, 62. Okay. Well, actually, by the time I got there, the Air Force, for some reason, sent me all the way to the radar site first.
Mm-hmm.
So I went out there in July of 62.
Mm-hmm.
Then drove back across country, which was a wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm.
Two-lane road back then, Route 66 and all that. Two-lane road back to Biloxi. That was interesting driving through the south. And then did the schooling and then went back to the radar site. So I was probably back there for the holidays of 62.
Okay. Okay.
And then I was there for about the first 3 years of my career.
Okay, till about 65?
Yeah, because I had I was in a AFSC that was, I think, called a critical specialty, and so I couldn't get released for pilot training until I finished my commitment.
Okay. Tell me what you remember about the Cuban Missile Crisis in the fall of 62.
Well, yeah, I came, we were at the school, and all of a sudden the you there?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, this headset, sorry.
It's okay.
The cryptography center was under armed guard. I'm going to take a drink of water just a second.
Okay.
You need to do that?
I have been, actually. Okay, go ahead.
It was really peripheral. Didn't affect us much. We didn't have to do very much. I remember, being intrigued with the aircraft reconnaissance operation that was going on. I think we lost an F-101, and then we lost a U-2, I think. And when I got back to the radar site, though, because it was still ongoing, I think, at that point, do you have some dates in front of you?
This is in October 62.
Yeah, how long did it go on?
14 days.
Hmm.
13 days, actually.
Yeah, I don't know now why I remember we went to an increased DEFCON at the radar site. I don't know what the heck that was about. Okay, so it really didn't. I don't know that I was so immersed in all the, you know, all that was going on in my life and school and everything else, and I was taking some outside classes in television technology just because I had the opportunity
mm-hmm.
at night. I was busy, and you know, mm-hmm. and I was relatively unaware of how serious it was, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't know that I had much of a big world perspective at that point in my
okay.
life. I was maybe what you'd say a typical engineer. I was more focused on equipment and things like that, and
mm-hmm.
I wasn't really into politics then. While I was aware of the racial thing, I didn't become involved in any civil rights issues.
Mm-hmm.
I was really immersed in my life, and
mm-hmm.
I had probably a pretty tunnel vision at that point.
Okay. That's one thing I was going to ask you is, mm-hmm. you know, when did you kind of get a larger context view of what the United States was doing in Southeast Asia in the initial stages
yeah,
of the conflict?
Yeah, we can talk about that when we get there, because
yeah.
that was a real change of heart for me.
Okay, okay. Tell me about your duties in Santa Cruz. What did you do?
Well, here I was a brand new brown bar lieutenant
mm-hmm.
At a radar site where, when I first got there, we were mostly an automated site. We were just going back to what's called Buick,
mm-hmm.
B-U-I-C, backup intercept control.
Okay.
So that was just coming back in. They had gone to an Air Defense Command.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. We could talk about this for hours and hours. Air Defense Command had gone into this sort of remoted operation. So
mm-hmm.
at the radar site, we provided radar height and range information, two different pieces of equipment,
mm-hmm.
very high-powered radar equipment. Was sent back on landline, which wasn't even secure, which is always that started me on what the heck are we doing, sort of questioning.
Mm-hmm.
We sent that information to, it was supposed to be a center in San Francisco, and maybe for budget reasons they closed that, and so we sent it to Los Angeles, and so
mm-hmm.
the Los Angeles Air Defense Sector, LADS, and they had controllers there, and it was supposed to be this rather automated equipment,
mm-hmm.
and then they would send the intercept information back to us on landline, and we had, and this was my primary responsibility, we had what they call a gator, ground-to-air transmitter receiver site,
mm-hmm.
and so we had both voice radio and this new-fangled transistorized equipment that
mm-hmm.
sent digital or pulse data to the interceptors, and these were F-102s and F-106s.
Mm-hmm.
The F-106s had a notorious reputation. They spent so much time on the ground for maintenance problems
mm-hmm.
because the airplane was extremely high-performance aerodynamic and high Gs and so forth, and it was still tube technology.
Mm-hmm.
So the equipment evidently was, you know, not compatible with the performance of the aircraft.
Right.
And so the equipment would always break down, and so the airplanes were mostly grounded,
mm-hmm.
and so, you know, there was this threat that they were going to paint them yellow like the rest of the ground equipment
mm-hmm.
at the airplane. So as I got to the site, my job was to supervise the telecommunication center, which was teletype and this, you know, switchboard operation.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where we did our cryptography.
Okay.
So I was the crypto officer. And I was a staff officer to a lieutenant colonel. I worked actually under a major who was the radar, so he was the electronics officer,
mm-hmm.
and I worked actually for him, and then for the, you know, through him to the colonel, but I had some staff responsibilities to the colonel.
Okay.
And I also managed all the enlisted people that were at this Gator site.
Mm-hmm.
So we had round-the-clock maintenance technicians.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very bright enlisted people, terribly underpaid. And that was one of my first real issues with the way the Air Force was run at that
mm-hmm.
point, was the promotion system.
Mm-hmm.
So my duties were to supervise those people, and so I was going to say I was here. I was 22 years old, and I was counseling sergeants on their financial responsibility to their families.
Wow.
You know, helping develop a supply inventory system
mm-hmm.
for spare parts. And it was really interesting until I started thinking about the bigger picture. And then I was starting to have my first confusions about the way the world worked.
Mm-hmm.
It was really challenging, just being responsible for, I guess, initially about 75 people,
mm-hmm.
Including, I had tech and master sergeants that worked for me. And
right.
I never failed to understand their age,
mm-hmm.
perspective, their experience, and their counsel.
Mm-hmm.
But I still had to sign the papers and make the decisions.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, you realize that's what you have to do, and you do that, and give them all the respect they deserve, and take their counsel seriously,
mm-hmm.
and never never abuse that.
Mm-hmm.
I was broken in by a chief master sergeant, Stephen Kish,
mm-hmm.
who I overheard him saying what I wasn't supposed to hear him saying. He was wet nursing again. He used to refer to himself as a titless WAF because he had all these administrative responsibilities.
Uh-huh.
But I couldn't have done my job without Steve,
and
I always let him know that. And,
mm-hmm.
How
were you as a leader?
I did what I had to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think for most of us, you just do the job.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things I really enjoyed about the Air Force experience. You just get thrown in, and I didn't have the experience these people have. I didn't have the age that my NCOs did.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I was the one that was responsible. And then, at some point, you just do the job, and I just always try to do it in a way that I respected the people that reported to me.
Mm-hmm.
I still had to write their performance reports.
Right.
That scene, and I didn't write Steve Kish's, the major did.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would have been really an insult to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the major also wrote I essentially wrote the report, but he was the signer for the master sergeants, and that
mm-hmm.
only seemed proper.
Mm-hmm.
I did write the reports on tech sergeants, which are E6s, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's what I had to do, and that's what I did.
Tell me about the technology there. I mean, this is kind of the part of the infancy stage of
mm-hmm.
some of this. What was your impression there of the technology?
Well, the new stuff was, it wasn't brown, first of all. It was gray, and it,
mm-hmm.
It was interesting equipment.
Mm-hmm.
I worked with the. We were also putting in a new telephone network
mm-hmm.
with AT&T, which eventually became. It's still in use, and I can't think of the name of it right now. But we had I have a pair of golden retrievers here, and
okay.
they're needing a break.
Do you want to take a break?
Yeah, maybe
okay.
we should do that.
Let's do that.
And I'll take.
Okay, go ahead.
I was just saying that encouragement, I think, is an important factor in how we get to be the people we are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in my family and in the environment I grew up in, being able to work with your hands was something that was valued.
Mm-hmm.
And the people you grow up holding in admiration.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather and one uncle were particularly important role models to me, and some neighbors, and
mm-hmm.
they all did with their hands.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of it is, you know, I think we emulate and attempt to emulate the adults that, I mean, that's why kids, you know, also suffer in the other direction, is because the role models are not there, or
mm-hmm.
they're so negative,
mm-hmm.
And so you emulate what you grew up around. I mean, I think that's, family is so important in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, the values that are held up in the home. And, you know, on the racial and the ethnic prejudices, I think it's the gossip that gets talked about.
Mm-hmm.
I think I struggled more with a sense of anti-Semitism for a long time myself,
mm-hmm.
because that was talked about in the family. And I don't know, and I've never understood whether that's from jealousy or, you know, or what's there. You know, I mean, stereotypes are so damaging. But in my family, other than some occasional comments about my father that I recall, and I think I recall them because they just, I was sorry to hear my father say that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that he was, you know, Dad was not a terrible racist by any means.
Right.
There weren't many blacks in our area, so they didn't get talked about. I remember
mm-hmm.
when the Puerto Ricans started immigrating, that was talked about, and, you know, that got negative press.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think those are, you know, I know you can never speak, and you can't do inductive, you know, you can't go from the specific to the general for
mm-hmm.
why things are so, but I think those were some of the things that
okay.
were so for me, just to finish that out.
You said you were reflecting upon that during our break.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, while I was out walking, letting the dogs stroll around.
I'm
sitting out now on the deck in the sun because it's so beautiful.
I can hear your wind chimes.
Yeah.
Let's continue talking about your duty in California. We had talked
okay.
about your leadership qualities.
Right.
And we were talking about some of the equipment, the technology, and that's where we had left off.
Right. So you were asking about what it was like to be in this, I guess, a supervisor or you know, deal with what responsibilities were given. I mean, you had to answer to the colonel, and he was looking for, you know, when you went to a staff briefing, you were the one that had to address
mm-hmm.
why this was so and why that was so and why this airman was in, you know, in trouble. Or
mm-hmm.
so, you know, when you went back to your section, you know, you just dealt with what had to be dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, because that was what was getting attention somewhere else, and
mm-hmm.
You also rely on the other young lieutenants and, you know, sort of pull some strength from them,
mm-hmm.
pull some strength from them. And I had a young captain that was a West Pointer
mm-hmm.
who was took an Air Force commission, and he was a real mentor. And so, you know, you got some guidance from them, and you had to deal with what was on your plate
mm-hmm.
and in your inbox.
Mm-hmm.
So you just did,
okay.
and you learned to do that. And most of the, all of the, you know, you might, I mean, and I had a couple of enlisted people who would test you, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
but most of them were wonderfully professional people,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, they were trying to do their job, and they understood that you could facilitate them doing their job by, you know, if they gave you the information and their support, then I could do my job, make sure they had the equipment, help them deal with the personnel problems they had. And so, you know, you had a symbiotic relationship with them.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that were successful understood about rank, and you know, we just didn't make that an issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They treated you with the decorum that the military required, and I think as long as if you let them sense that you were in their corner, pulling with them, and not, you know, and not arrogant about your role, you know, I remember saying to one sergeant, you know, I put my pants on just the same way you do,
mm-hmm.
And you know, I just have my jobs that I have to do, and you have your jobs,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, we work together as a team,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and most of the good guys, they understood that you had to do your role as the officer, and they were great about it. They made it easy.
Right.
Most guys didn't test you or push that issue.
Did you find that true throughout your career?
Yes. I mean, that was true even to the airline.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I might have just as much experience as the captain when I was a first officer or something. In some cases, you might even be older than the captain.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, he was the one that signed for the airplane, and that was true out on the line. I mean, I had an instructor when I was in pilot training who was a second lieutenant, and I was a first lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, John was just doing his job, and his job was to be the instructor. My job was to be the student.
Mm-hmm.
So, that, you know, that was perfectly fine.
Okay. You said that during your time in California is when you started to kind of get a bigger picture of
mm-hmm.
the world and the world context. Tell me about that.
Again, this interesting. I was just reminiscing this to my wife Joy the other night.
Mm-hmm.
I remember because we were out in California. I remember standing on the radar site one night, and there was a SAC would try to penetrate the air defense identification zone, the ADIS,
mm-hmm.
And because they always had the most advanced electronic countermeasures,
mm-hmm.
and our electronic countermeasures always were lagging behind for budget because SAC had the big budget,
mm-hmm.
Strategic Air Command, and under LeMay, General LeMay,
mm-hmm.
And so the only way we could ever find them was someone at the FAA would be good enough to help us know where SAC had filed to penetrate the ADIS, because they did have to do that, and
uh-huh.
we would have our intelligence sources. And so we'd know the area to look, but we still
mm-hmm.
necessarily didn't have an easy time finding them because they'd have their jammers on, and
mm-hmm.
our counter jammers were not always good enough to cut through. But anyway, so there was one of these missions going on, and, you know, I don't know, I was saying to my wife, I don't know why I wasn't on the, what they call the dais, the room where we had the plotting board. Back then you still had a plotting board,
mm-hmm.
and had people that plotted the airplanes, and an officer and an enlisted person would be on the scopes, and they would be directing the interceptor, if they could find any place to direct them.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I don't know why it was not necessary for me to be always on the dais with the colonel, but one of my jobs was to float around and you know, like go out to the transmitter site or up to the radar tower and, you know, check and see how things were going and just talk to the folks and
mm-hmm.
See if there were any impending problems that maybe could be dealt with preemptively.
Mm-hmm.
So I was outside all by myself and standing looking up the Santa Clara Valley towards San Francisco, and you know, the glow from the city was up there, and I thought, you know, if the Russians, who were our enemy back then, if they were to launch ballistic missiles,
mm-hmm.
and they did, they were going to do an airburst over San Francisco, they were going to do a ground burst,
mm-hmm.
and I'd look up at the radar facility, and I think, that damn thing's not even going to be here. You know, that overpressure would wipe us out. Plus
mm-hmm.
the electronic, the call the EMF, electromagnetic interference from the radiation burst,
mm-hmm.
which, I mean, the radar just wouldn't be there. Physically
right.
wouldn't be there, and
right.
electronically it'd be devastating.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what the hell are we doing here? I mean, mm-hmm. this is really a futile effort, but and we couldn't even find the SAC bombers, you know, so and our interceptors, the Air Defense Command was not getting much of a budget priority.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was mostly for the public, you know, just to say that we had this, we were protecting, I mean, I wonder about that even today, you know,
mm-hmm.
we're protecting the homeland. So anyway, you know, I started looking at this and thinking, boy, you know, you could really screw yourself into the ground in negativity,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and I couldn't afford to do that. But it felt hypocritical to talk mission to my, you know, the folks that looked to me when I wasn't really believing anymore that we were going to be there to do our job when the war came,
mm-hmm.
and that started to present a real hollow feeling. And I don't know, somewhere I think I rationalized I just needed to do what I was asked to do the best I could, and you know, and maybe I didn't understand all the big picture, and you know, and I still had my own career, and that sowed some seeds of disillusionment for sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that I was just doing what I needed to do to, so I could, my own career could be advanced. And I started to feel out of integrity.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't feel very good. And then pilot training came along, and I forgot all that. Just went, to, you know, because I was so excited. And,
uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Until I got to Vietnam, and then it started all over again.
Right. When did you start pilot training?
I went up to Hamilton Air Force Base for a physical. Mm-hmm. I decided I was going to make Air Force a career. And,
you decided that?
Yeah. I liked the people I worked with, and the military life had been for me to that point quite lovely. I mean,
okay.
even though I was at a radar site, it was right outside of San Jose and had access to San Francisco. And
mm-hmm.
You know, when you were not working, you went off the site. Living up at the site was just beautiful. We were at 3,000 feet,
mm-hmm.
actually 3,500. And so often you'd look down on the weather.
mm-hmm.
You'd be in the sunshine. And, of course, some days we'd be in the clouds and they'd be in the sunshine.
Mm-hmm.
Living up there was just nice. And, I liked a lot about the military life. I liked the people. So I went up to... So when I decided I was going to stay in, I noticed all the officers had wings,
mm-hmm.
and so I started talking to a few of them that were sort of mentors, and you know, they said, you know, if you're going to stay in and make higher rank, and it was certainly true at that point, you needed to be rated,
mm-hmm.
And many of them were navigators. So I thought, well, you know, I knew I couldn't be a pilot. So I'd apply for navigator training. That
mm-hmm.
was still fine. I'd be around airplanes, and that was great.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to Hamilton, Richard, you've already found out I'm a talker, so.
Yes, sir. No, go right ahead.
Okay.
This is what this is about.
Okay. And you need to just shut me down when it's. I try not to get off on too many tangents. You've asked some, you know, good questions, so. You've helped direct me.
Well, you feel free to talk as
okay.
much as you want to.
So I went to Hamilton to take the physical,
mm-hmm.
and while I was in college, my mother, my mother, like most sons' mothers, just, you know, my sweetheart,
mm-hmm.
She would do just about anything for her firstborn, oldest son,
mm-hmm.
Italian family. You,
mm-hmm.
you know about that.
Yes, sir.
And, we had a family optometrist who I went to see about reading glasses.
Mm-hmm.
I found out, you know, I had this vision issue. And he was a great guy who... See, here's another instance where this man was Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
Many of my teachers, and as was very typical, may still be typical in the New York City public school system, were Jewish. So I had lots of, you know, very important people in my life from elsewhere. Anyway, he was doing experiments on eye exercises, strengthening eye muscles.
Mm-hmm.
And he needed test subjects.
Okay.
And my mother was willing to pay some modest amount of money so I could do these eye exercises. And I never thought about them.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that continued. I didn't start that. I said high school. I think it was actually college. And so I would go to his office and work with him and do these exercises. But I never realized how significantly they improved my eye muscle, which turned out was the issue of my
mm-hmm.
vision problem. And so when I went to take this navigator exam, I finally went through, I did all the doctors and all the tests and finally went through the eye doctor. And I went for my debriefing.
Mm-hmm.
And so the doctor says, well, everything looks fine. Your paperwork should just be great. And I said, well, what else would I have to do? You know, these questions that just sort of pop out. I hadn't
mm-hmm.
even thought, what else would I have to do in order to, what other exam would I have to have taken to be able to apply for pilot training? And he looked at my paperwork and he said, you can apply for pilot training. Well, you know, after I picked myself up off the floor,
mm-hmm.
I remember riding back to the radar site the most. I don't remember much about the ride, is all
mm-hmm.
I could say. I was just on cloud nine. And I got back, and of course, you know, the colonel was a pilot, and the officer I worked for was a pilot, and my mentor had been a pilot. So they were just all ecstatic for me. And,
mm-hmm.
and so from that point on, and I don't remember, it was not quite a year before I went to pilot training, which was May, now let's see, we started April of 65.
Mm-hmm.
So sometime in 64, I applied and then got back the acceptance probably by that summer or something. And so from that time on, of course, my only focus was going to pilot training
mm-hmm.
and waiting for the class assignment.
Okay. And where was the training going to take place?
Eventually, I was assigned to pilot training at Del Rio Laughlin Air Force Base.
Okay. All right. And when did you actually leave to go to Del Rio?
Say that one more time.
I'm sorry. When did you actually leave to go to Del Rio?
I think we went home. Took an extended leave
mm-hmm.
in March. And went home, because that's the first time I'd been back to New York City. You know, you didn't.
Hmm.
How did you go from California to New York back in those days? You certainly didn't jump on airplanes like you do
right.
today. The fares were
right.
prohibitive, and it just it was not. I didn't even know anybody that flew on a commercial airline.
Mm-hmm. This is in 1964.
Right.
Okay.
And then the trip actually was in March of 65.
Okay.
And so I went home, saw the family. You know, my sister got married, I think,
mm-hmm.
and so I was able to be there for the wedding. That was all fortuitous.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went off to pilot training.
Okay. Well, tell me about pilot training. What was it like?
You know, just heaven for
uh-huh.
somebody who always wanted to be around airplanes.
Right.
I mean, you started right out in the I'm trying to remember now. You know, at Delta you did extensive ground school before you ever saw a Delta airplane.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we started flying pretty early on. We probably had some initial classroom. But pretty quick, they had you down the line because, I mean, unfortunately, at that point, we were still washing out 50% of the guys.
Wow.
That was unsettling, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be at a table with three guys and your instructor, and the next day there'd be two of you and your instructor. And,
right.
And old John just disappeared. A lot of times the guys never said anything because they were embarrassed, and the instructors didn't say anything because they, didn't want to gossip about anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So John just wasn't there anymore, and then mm-hmm. you found out John was gone.
Did you ever have a fear of washing out?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Okay. I had a very laconic captain who was my initial instructor in the T-37.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing great. I was scheduled to be the first in my class to solo. I was doing really well,
mm-hmm.
and I was doing well academically.
Mm-hmm. So you had classroom training? And
yeah,
then
you had class. You did classroom part of the day and, mm-hmm. and flight line part of the day.
Okay.
And most of the flying was in the morning, but it wasn't always so. Anyway, his name was Roy Woodson,
mm-hmm.
and, I really had a lot of admiration for him. He was a nice guy, but he was quiet. At least I didn't have one of those glare shield pounders, as we call them,
mm-hmm.
guys that would beat on the glare shield, poke you while you were flying.
Right.
I mean, they were all different. Like all teachers, there's different methodology.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Roy was just a great guy, and I had a nice relationship with him. And I went up for my pre-solo ride, and he didn't like something.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't tell me what he didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
And he just, what they call, gave me a pink, which is a down.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was not up to solo. Well, that hurt, but
mm-hmm.
all right, so I went up the next day, and I was all ready again, and he did the same thing to me.
Hmm.
And I didn't know what was going on, and he didn't tell me anything. Well, now somebody else was scheduled with solo, so that prestige was gone,
mm-hmm.
and boy, I was starting to get a real sinking spell. And I was fortunate. I was living off base again, and one of my neighbors was another instructor, a young lieutenant,
mm-hmm.
and he was just a couple apartments down from me, and so I knew him from hanging around the pool or just seeing him. And so I went down and talked to him, and bless his heart, he spent several hours that evening, and we just talked.
Mm-hmm.
And he, without it seeing me flying, he finally deciphered that I was throwing out, they're a thrust reducer, but what they are, they're a deflector that throws, so that you can keep the engine spooled up and producing power,
mm-hmm.
because the engines in the T-37 are quite small, and you don't want the lag time.
Mm-hmm.
If you needed power, you could just retract these deflectors, and you'd have instant power. But I was throwing them out, and then not advancing power soon enough to compensate
mm-hmm.
for that degradation once they were in the thrust stream.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was dropping airspeed a little bit. But I don't know why Roy just never pointed it out to me.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a check captain, so he would give evaluation rides. And maybe he got caught in a quandary. I don't know. I never got to talk to him again because then he was no longer my instructor. I wound up being assigned to that second lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
But I went up the next day and just did what the lieutenant had coached me. Did fine. Roy got out of the airplane, and I soloed and went on. And then I got reassigned to a younger actually, he was the first lieutenant. The second lieutenant was later,
mm-hmm.
T-38. So, that was really unnerving. I mean,
right.
We'd already seen people fall by the wayside, and now, that was really awful.
How did it feel when you soloed for the first time?
As we all said, you suddenly heard noises in the airplane you never heard before. It's so amazingly quiet when
uh-huh.
you're just there in the airplane by yourself.
Uh-huh.
You hear every pump. You hear valve cycling.
Uh-huh.
And then the confidence level. And with Air Force pilot training, like I'm sure naval and marine, naval training for the, whoever, the other pilot training programs,
mm-hmm.
All do the same thing. They really work to instill a sense of confidence. So you
mm-hmm.
do a lot of things to build confidence. And
right.
You go out and do acrobatics and so forth. And so solo flights then became treasured moments because you were out there all by yourself with just this airplane. And,
mm-hmm.
and it was great. And then, you have all the camaraderie, a lot of camaraderie
mm-hmm.
in the class, a lot of social activity, lot of hanging out. So, you know, it's just another age of innocence, if you will.
Right. How long did the training last?
55 weeks.
Okay. Pretty significant amount of time.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, back then it cost just under $400,000 to train an Air Force pilot, and that's in 1966 dollars. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. When you think back about your pilot training, what do you remember most? What comes to mind?
The T-38 aircraft, which is the advanced trainer. And, of course, back then they were brand new.
Right.
I mean, I flew one that just had been delivered, and I flew it solo, and it smelled like a new car. And, you know, just, of course, they were a high-performance aircraft. And I remember sitting around the pool watching the guys in the traffic pattern going into at the base when I was only in T-37s, and just, wow, you know, just couldn't wait until we got to T-38 because that was, you know, you got to wear a G-suit. So, you know, T-37s were called the Tweety Bird, so, you know, there was nothing glamorous about it, you know. So T-38s were, you know, just that and formation flying. Turning out of traffic when you're on the wing and looking up at the lead airplane, and it's just framed against the blue sky. This is a memorable sight that I can still pull up.
How did you do ranking as far as your class was concerned?
I wound up finishing in the middle of my class.
Okay.
And I had another harrowing time on my final formation check in T-38, and that cost me a couple of places in the class. So I missed the last fighter slot by one.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just the way it goes.
Right. What happened that you said that incident?
There's a maneuver called the formation rejoin, and you separate from the lead aircraft, and then you have to close on him and into position. You know, we flew about a 3-foot wingtip separation, and I didn't do it smoothly, and I didn't do it well. It was sort of awkward and jerky, and it was on my check ride, so I wound up getting a down on that. But because, I mean, we lost guys in T-38s, and that was really surprising to see somebody go that far and still get washed out.
Wow.
And so, boy, I really felt the pressure. And, and so I had to go up for another ride, and went on up the next day. I did fine, but that doing that poorly the first time cost me it a couple of slots. Mm-hmm. I mean, a couple of numbers in the ranking.
Tell me what the Air Force was teaching you guys as far as doctrine and strategy was concerned. Was that touched upon during this 55-week course?
Absolutely nothing.
Oh, really? Okay.
And the whole time I was in, even when I was in Vietnam, one of the things that really still bothers me is not once did we ever go to a briefing in which anybody talked about our mission. The only thing we were talked to about, nor did anybody ever ask me my opinion. And by that time, I was a captain with, 6-7 years service, and a potential career officer. Not once did anybody ever, we never had a general or a colonel come in and talk to us about what we were doing. The only thing they ever talked about was, on-time takeoffs. Could you believe this? This is a war, but we're talking about on-time takeoffs, the amount of reliability for, which I understand. Reliability is important, but I mean, how you do the mission to me should also be important. We were doing airlift, so we weren't like time on target for bomb delivery. I had that mission too, but that was treated differently. But still, nobody ever came and talked to us. I had once had to brief a one star about the bomb mission. I was dropping those daisy cutters, you know, he came for a briefing on the weapon system, but, you know, even he never asked us, you know, anything about what we thought. He never said anything about what our role was there. You had to interpret that all for yourself, and that was really disheartening. So I mean, I'm sure we'll get to another place where we'll talk about this more.
Mm-hmm.
But hold on, here's my wife and my friend.
Okay.
I started to really just formulate my own reason for being there.
Mm-hmm.
When I saw the Marines at Khe Sanh, which I arrived in Vietnam on a Monday, and Wednesday I was air landing and air dropping into Khe Sanh.
Wow.
During the siege.
Wow.
And you know, you'd look out the window. Here I was all excited to be flying over there, and I'd look out and look at those Marines and realize, you know, just look at the expression on their faces, and especially the ones that were not getting to board my airplane to
mm-hmm.
leave there, you know,
mm-hmm.
and understood that there was a seriousness to this that I didn't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And I just heard some commentary on NPR either yesterday or this morning in which somebody was saying the same thing, that, you know, you train for all this, but then, you know, it seems like an adventure. And then when you see, as I did, I remember a black soldier, either a Marine or Army, head wrapped in bandages,
mm-hmm.
Bottles into both arms, because sometimes we did air-evac flights. The 130 was one wonderfully
mm-hmm.
versatile airplane. And, you know, he was dripping blood onto the floor of the airplane, and two bottles were going in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I started to realize, or at least formulate for myself, rationalizing, my job was to support the troops in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my job. And I, at that point, you know, I could care less about the politics.
Mm-hmm.
My job was to do the best job I could for the Marines and the Army, and, you know, get them what they needed.
Mm-hmm.
Because I, you know, that's the only thing I could affect at that point.
Right. What do you attribute the Air Force's kind of lack of asking what your opinion was or getting your input after a lot of experience on mission?
Yeah, now you've invited me to step into the vernacular. You know, I always felt like the Air Force sucked up to the suits.
Mm-hmm.
Politicians,
yeah,
and I understand that, and want our military to be totally subordinate to the civilian government.
Mm-hmm.
But the Air Force always seemed to just suck up to whoever, you know, generals make, as I understand it, make rank. The colonels I know that didn't stay on
mm-hmm.
and were extremely gifted and talented, and I admired. They didn't stay on because of the politics.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to be a general by being very political. I have two neighbors, both African American.
Mm-hmm.
Both were 06s in the Army. Both very, very successful. One went on to be a CEO of a major cities convention
mm-hmm.
center, and the other one was a senior executive at a major food business,
mm-hmm.
Big food business, national. You know, neither of these guys, they both said, and they both were friends of Colin Powell,
mm-hmm.
they both said, you know, you had to be political to go on. Anyway, so I always thought that they, the generals, I never, you know, I didn't have much interaction with generals,
mm-hmm.
of course. And I knew two, and both one stars. And our generals always seemed to just, you know, we never even had a uniform that looked like a uniform. It looked like a business suit.
Hmm.
You look at a Marine, you
mm-hmm.
know that's a military guy. You look
mm-hmm.
at a naval officer, you know that's an officer.
Mm-hmm.
You look at an Air Force guy, and for the longest time, you know, we didn't even have silver braid. You had blue braid on blue suit. To be as I always felt like it was to be as inconspicuous as possible. And I just always resented that.
Why do you think that was?
I don't know. They didn't want to be military, right? You know, it was like, and of course then we had, I grew up in the era of Secretary McNamara,
mm-hmm.
who I hold in deep disdain.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, his job was to create numbers that justified whatever they decision making.
Right.
And I understand about justification. I have an MBA,
mm-hmm.
but I also know what bean counters can do to a corporation. And and I felt like that's a mentality he brought to the Pentagon, and the Air Force in particular sucked up to that.
Mm-hmm.
To get, you know, LeMay was one of the last of the generals who had any personality. Mm-hmm. After that, you don't. What memorable general, Air Force general, sticks out? You know, Hap Arnold,
mm-hmm.
and General LeMay, and Jimmy Doolittle probably.
Mm-hmm.
But other than those, I don't think of any Air Force generals.
Mm-hmm.
But I know about Army generals.
Mm-hmm.
I know about admirals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Air Force just, I don't know. It was always about money and for these very expensive weapon systems, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
I'm too far down the line to offer any real insight into that, but that's what it looked like from the field.
Okay. Did this feeling increase the longer you were in the Air Force, and then, or did it develop more after you got out of the service in 1970?
No, it got pretty strong over there because I didn't feel like I saw some really poor commanders who, C-130s, maybe if you'd been in a fighter unit, you had more gung-ho.
Mm-hmm.
But in C-130s, we had a lot of colonels, lieutenant colonels, who had been pulled back to the line
mm-hmm.
Because they were running out of pilots. And so they started bringing guys who, were from the Korean War and so forth. And that was fine. But these guys came back, and the only thing they were doing was covering their 6 o'clock
mm-hmm.
Because they all hoped to make, 06.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm going to tell you one story, but I think it says a lot.
Okay.
I was with my squadron commander, Lieutenant Colonel, who I liked. I mean, he was a guy that one night I was at the officers' club with my wife and we were celebrating an anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in the club and he saw us over there and he somehow knew about that and he sent a bottle of champagne over.
Okay.
You know, I was really impressed. That was just so thoughtful. And
mm-hmm.
he was, he was a nice guy. And then I was in his office one day for some operational matter, and the telephone rang, and it was the wing commander, who is an 06.
Mm-hmm.
And while Colonel Lancaster's talking to me, he reaches into his bottom drawer and pulls a pair. Well, now, we're flying in Vietnam, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
He pulls out a pair of spit-shine shoes
mm-hmm.
to put on to walk over to see the colonel. And I thought, holy shit, I mean, people are dying out there, and this guy's worried about his spit-shine shoes to go see the colonel?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that really, I mean, that was like a crushing blow to whatever vestige of pride I had.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
How long into your tour did that happen?
That was, I was an aircraft commander, and I was probably well into my almost second year over there.
Okay.
We did a longer tour because we weren't, because of McNamara's and the all the number crunching that went on,
mm-hmm.
we weren't based in country.
Right.
We did all our flying in country, but they based us in the
mm-hmm.
Philippines, and that
right.
way we didn't count against the force structure of 500,000.
Mm-hmm.
So I wound up, I flew 1,000 sorties while I was there
mm-hmm.
in 22 months, and I got credit for, one Vietnam tour. So
huh.
That's just the way it worked.
Right.
So I'm sorry, Richard, but
yes,
if you really don't mind me talking,
no.
I still have somewhere in my papers I got threatened with a court-martial.
While you were in Vietnam?
Yes.
Okay.
And here's the gist of it, and I have the paperwork to prove it.
Okay.
My story is documented officially. I had an air evac mission, and so that meant you picked up an airplane, you configured it with litters, and you spent the day going out to pick up from the field hospitals people that had been, the pronunciation is triage. They'd been triaged, and they had had the initial, you know, medical care, and then we needed to take them to the hospitals, either in Da Nang or Cam Ranh or Saigon. And I had, we have a unit on the airplane called a ground power, it's not a ground power unit, it's a GTC, gas turbine compressor, which is built into the airplane, but you start it, it's a small, and then you use the power, the air and the electricity from that to start the aircraft engines, okay? And so you, that way you're self-sufficient. You don't need a ground unit when you go out in the field, because we landed at dirt strips and pieces of road or whatever they had. And that unit was not working. Well, that would mean that when I went out to a dirt strip, which we were going to do, I would have to leave probably two engines running, which would mean when we had the ramp at the back of the airplane down, that all that, those fumes would be coming into the airplane, the dust, and you know, and we had litter cases, and I had medical personnel, and so we had plenty of time to fix that unit, and I had a 13-hour day, or at least a 12-hour day, I can't remember, and I only needed about 7 hours to make all the stops that we were scheduled to. And so I could accomplish all that and have the unit fixed before we started. We'd be behind a little bit, but we'd be much better. Anyway, so the sergeant, my flight engineer, told me about the problem. I said, okay, well, let's get them to fix it. I'm not going to take the airplane until we're ready because of the mission profile. So then all of a sudden I'm sitting there doing some looking at some paperwork for the airplane, and all of a sudden there's a maintenance sergeant there, and he says, I understand you want to have this airplane fixed. And I said, oh, yeah, absolutely. We have plenty of time. I explained to him. Okay, so he goes away. Well, the next thing is a captain is standing there asking the same questions. And then finally, I don't remember where it went from there, but eventually there's a full colonel, the maintenance officer, the wing maintenance officer standing there, and he starts berating me for not wanting to fly the airplane. And eventually, and I told him, you know, where we were going. I knew they didn't have any ground units, and he orders me to take the airplane. And so I asked him, I said, Colonel, that's a direct order. Is that right, sir? And he said, absolutely, you get your ass up in the airplane, you know, whatever. And
where was this taking place?
Cam Ranh Bay.
Okay.
And fortunately, I had a medical... I don't know that he was a doctor. He's a medical, like, administrative officer, so he was responsible for the medical mission in the back of the airplane. And he and I had worked together before. And I was, you know, I really always tried to do the best job I could because that was what I understood my purpose there. And I thought, as we flew around, of course, he told me that there were ground power units at the places I said there weren't and everything else. So he had said all this in public. And when we were flying around doing it, of course, we got to those places. They didn't have any ground power units because it was listed in the we had a supplemental book for those little dirt strips so that we had some idea of what was there and how long it was and how wide. I still have a copy of that. And... he had, of course, he had lied to me, and I knew he was lying. He just wanted me to. He wanted an on-time takeoff. That's what he wanted.
Okay.
He wanted the airplane dispatched within the window of opportunity, that gave him an on-time reliability. And so, I was really pissed by that point. because I'd go in back of the airplane and hear the engines running. I'd leave the co-pilot up and the engineer up there, you know, and it just stank of jet fuel, exhaust fumes, and it was dusty. And I got angry and angry as we went on. And so I decided to write all that up. And I filed a report with my squadron operations officer, who was a great guy. He was, you know, a guy that had his feet on the ground. Didn't keep the Chinese shoes in his car.
Right.
And
was this the same colonel who did that?
No.
Okay.
No. It was an 06 that did it. At the squadron level, we had only 05s.
Okay.
So I gave a copy of my report. We made a copy when we got back. I think we did have copy machines back then.
Okay.
And I gave it to the medical officer.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, he filed that same report to hit with his endorsement on it to his chain of command, which went through the Surgeon General, or whatever he was called, in Vietnam.
Okay.
So the next day, myself and my operations officer are called to the wing commander's office, and this guy threatens me with a court-martial for my performance the previous day, borderline insurrection, insubordination, and et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And so the phone rings. And all of a sudden, this full colonel jumps up out of his chair and is standing at attention, talking into the phone. Yes, General. Yes, General. Yes, General. When he hangs up the phone, he turns to me and he says, "You're dismissed from here. Don't let me see you again." So my operations officer, as we walked out, he just winked at me and said, "I'll find out what's going on." Well, that medical officer's report went through the medical chain of command to MACV headquarters in Saigon, and that was the general who called back down and wanted to know from this colonel what the hell he was doing. So that day I was out flying and wound up, went through Saigon, and I was told, prepare to receive an 06 being brought back to Cameron Bay. And so you have a VIP code. And so we had him on board, and he came up. And, of course, we invited him to sit on the flight deck, which is much more comfortable than the back of the airplane. And he observed the crew, and he talked to us and everything else. And I sort of had an inkling that this 06 may have something to do with this issue. It turned out he was the investigating officer.
Oh, really?
And so he got to watch me and my crew perform, and evidently was favorably impressed, and I never heard another word about that. My, you know, operations officer just told me, said, "Don't you ever even worry about that again." So
interesting.
Anyway, but
interesting.
That, you know, I'm sorry, that was a story that makes me feel good to tell because I was right. But it was that kind of situation that was terribly disillusioning to wanting to do the right thing.
Right.
And the system, and you know, and seeing an 06 behave like that, it's really troubling.
And that's a very good example of what you've been talking about.
Well, and that's why I brought it in. It's just because it did show a really unfortunate, unpleasant side. And, you know, and it's really consequential to mission accomplishment. I mean, kids are out there, their lives are on the line, and our only job was to support them. But, you know, some of these people, their only job was to, you know, to worry, about their next promotion.
How did you feel about, what did you think the attitude was of the rest of the men you were working with in your unit in relation to this issue?
Well, I was laughing because, you know, there were the captains and the lieutenants and the sergeants.
Right.
And we all just watched with some detached amusement from this. I mean, it really was, it was silly to watch grown men doing some of the things we watched the majors and the colonels doing. So these guys were all called back, and they're all worried about their promotions. And they're all trying to find jobs to do so that they can get a performance report. That was, I mean, it's terribly hard on them. I understand that. I mean, these are guys that had 16 to 18 years of service,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, they could get drummed out before their 20th year, and they would lose their retirement.
Right.
So I understand that they're feeling under a lot of pressure. I mean, they have families, and but so these guys are scrambling for make work jobs in the squadron, because in the Air Force, unfortunately, the other thing is you don't get promoted on being a good pilot. You have to have some kind of job. We
mm-hmm.
call it additional duty.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it was the most asinine, trivial stuff
mm-hmm.
to have some an officer. I mean, just as an air enlisted man, and I don't mean that pejoratively, but you didn't need an officer and a pilot to be doing some of these jobs.
Right.
But we were doing them so that when you got your performance report, I was the manuals control officer. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, we had to invent this system to control the issue with manuals. Well, I had lots of sergeants that could have done that, and that would have been good for their career.
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't need to have, certainly didn't need to have a captain doing it.
Right.
And I could have been more involved in, say, maintenance issues or something that, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But so these guys were all scrambling for their performance reports.
Mm-hmm.
And one day at a briefing, a squadron briefing, the colonel, the 05, is standing up there, and he finally puts down his notes, and he looks out at, it's all officers at this briefing,
mm-hmm.
all pilots or crew, and he says, "I don't understand something. When I was a young lieutenant, if I went to a briefing, I took pad and pencil, and I took notes."
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "Lieutenant Cox," who is a real free-spirited young lieutenant,
mm-hmm.
he says, "How come you don't have notes and a pad in front of you?"
Mm-hmm.
Lieutenant Cox gets up and says, "Sir, I've been coming to this briefing every morning this week, and every morning it's the same old shit." But that was really true. And, of course,
uh-huh.
there's all this. Did you ever see the Catch-22 or read the book?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, then you know what some of that was about.
Yes.
And that's what that I finally understood what was going on in Catch-22 mm-hmm. when I went to Vietnam.
Okay.
So, and Cox was right. And so, you know, that the colonel finally left in a fit of rage and
mm-hmm.
And there were other instances like that. So, you know, we watched in some detached amusement. And
mm-hmm.
by that time, I decided I couldn't stay. I mean, if this is the best we could do in wartime,
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't want to be a part of the peacetime. So,
how much of an opportunity?
And
is
I love the Air Force. I just didn't
right.
love the system.
Right, right. I gather that completely. Based
I was
on
just you know, sad that we could be doing so much better a job.
How much do you think that war is an opportunity for officers to progress their career?
Oh, hell. I remember being in the briefing room, you know, stupidly talking or innocently talking about coming back with a chest slathered with, you know, decorations
mm-hmm.
and, you know. And so we all thought it was very important to have combat experience.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it is, not in the Air Force. I mean, it may be in the Marines and the Army. But I think in the Air Force, it was, you know, how you did as a manuals control officer. And that was what was so sad.
Right, right. Okay, sir, we just took a brief break. Why don't we pick up with when you finish your pilot training
mm-hmm.
After your 55-week program. And you said you were about midway and you missed getting fighter pilot selection
mm-hmm.
by just a few slots. Is that what you had wanted to get?
Of course.
That's what everybody, I guess,
well,
wanted.
I've come to understand not everybody, but I think most of us,
uh-huh,
yeah,
uh-huh.
yeah.
And so how did you feel? I mean, how disappointed were you, and
well,
what did you do?
You know, I like all human, I think like most human beings, you have this wonderful ability to rationalize,
mm-hmm.
and it really turned out well for me.
Mm-hmm.
I would have gotten a backseat of an F-4.
Okay.
So, first of all, you wouldn't be a pilot. You'd be a systems operator.
Mm-hmm.
And then the guys, it turned out that did get those slots. They had to sign up. That they had to agree to stay on past their initial commitment before they could upgrade.
Okay.
So that meant spending your whole time as a backseater.
Mm-hmm.
And in the C-130, I knew that, first of all, I'd get to go more places.
Mm-hmm.
And I would get to upgrade a lot sooner to aircraft commander,
mm-hmm.
which is what you want to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so some guys were already talking about the airlines, and of course, it seemed like hell. You know, if you after Vietnam, maybe a 141 assignment, then
mm-hmm.
and then you know you'd have all this big jet time, and you'd be attractive candidate for the airlines
mm-hmm.
if you wanted just to have that in your back pocket.
Right.
So, so I don't think I stayed there very long. And some of my good friends who had done better in the class standing took C-130s
okay.
because the versatile airplane, and you know, it turned out to be a really great experience. I don't really know. If I could have been in a single seater, I might have traded the experience, but
mm-hmm.
I'm very happy for what happened.
Okay, so you chose C-130s.
Right. I certainly didn't want to go sack the B-52s.
Right.
Yeah, which just, you know, was the scorn of the pilot community, and we always felt like the guys at the bottom of the class went to sack. So
mm-hmm. okay.
That's not fair, but those guys did a good job, but
mm-hmm.
that mission was awful.
Right.
Yeah, and,
right.
and I happened to be a tenant unit in C-130s on a SAC base, and I found out that really was true.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So
the heyday of SAC was over, and it was just boring.
Right.
For
right.
duty.
This is 1966, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And you had to go for C-130 training, I take it?
Yes.
Okay, where did you go?
I went to Seward Air Force Base
mm-hmm.
In... near Nashville, Murfreesboro,
mm-hmm.
and that was wonderful. I had just a delightful time there. We just
okay.
two pilots and a great guy for an instructor who I am so sorry I don't know how to be in touch with him. I don't even have to look in my logbook to find out.
Mm-hmm.
And we just he trained us to fly the airplane as though we were airline captains.
Mm-hmm.
You know, always trying to be as smooth and as thoughtful of your passengers, because he said, you know, some days you're going to have litter patients back there, and
mm-hmm.
you don't want them to even know they've been moved.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a great guy with a great attitude, and we just went out and you had some more ground school,
mm-hmm.
but we did all our simulator training with him and all our flying with him,
mm-hmm.
and we just always had a really wonderful time just touring around the Murfreesboro, Nashville area,
mm-hmm.
low level in C-130, and he made it a very positive experience.
So it was just two of you training?
Well, I mean, there was a class, but you...
But you had...
But only when you were only in a smallish... And it was, I don't remember even how many guys were there, but it was only when you were in the classroom academic systems
mm-hmm.
training that you saw the other guys. You just hung with your instructor and,
okay.
and flew.
Okay. I've heard from other pilots, C-130
uh-huh.
pilots included, that... What kind of instructor you get is absolutely key to what kind of pilot you'll be and your experience in the service.
Yeah, yeah, and that was true in undergrad, you know, what they call UPT, undergraduate pilot training,
mm-hmm.
Because I had those. Once I got no longer was with a captain, I had two lieutenants,
mm-hmm.
and one was an Air Force Academy graduate, and he had a great attitude, and. Then I had that young second lieutenant, and, you know, they both treated me with respect, and in fact, I outranked, that, of course, that second lieutenant, and yet we had a wonderful relationship, and he was, yeah, so that, yeah, you're right. I mean, it makes
mm-hmm.
a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
And they were both really good pilots, and so, you know, you really could look up to them.
Mm-hmm.
They were great.
Tell me about the C-130 as an aircraft.
It seemed really big at the time. It doesn't seem so big now that I've flown
mm-hmm.
commercial. And it was exciting. You got to work with a crew, so there was, you know, crew concept came in there. You had a flight engineer, a navigator,
mm-hmm.
loadmaster in the back, and you had a co-pilot.
Mm-hmm.
We were trained in the left seat, so we were trained as an aircraft commander, which mm-hmm. was really nice, rather than just being trained as a helper.
Mm-hmm.
And the airplane is... it's hard to imagine, it would have been, that such a large airplane could have been as agile as it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we did all the short field work, and there was such a variety of missions. So, and all of our flight engineers were so great. They were, they were very professional.
Mm-hmm.
They were all highly experienced. We never had novice. So they were a key member of the crew. Your engineer... pre-flight of the airplane,
mm-hmm.
so he discovered what maintenance was hiding, if they were hiding anything.
Mm-hmm.
In the field, of course, if you got stuck at some little army post, say in Vietnam, some
mm-hmm.
fire base. Your engineer was the one who was going to get you out of there if you had trouble with the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
No, there was nobody else. And
right.
They were just really dedicated, great, hardworking. I try to always make it a point, I think as many aircraft commanders did, to always make sure my crew was fed,
mm-hmm.
housed when we were out on. Because in C-130s, you did a lot on your own,
mm-hmm.
unlike what used to be back then Military Airlift Command, MAC. We didn't operate out of so much control out of a central command post.
Mm-hmm.
When you were dispatched, you were fairly autonomous, and so you know your job was to take care of those people.
Mm-hmm.
And the first aircraft commanders I flew with set a very high standard for that, and so again, you know, that makes a big difference in how you behave. I think, you know,
right.
You learn.
Right. How did the C-130 handle compared? I mean, you were flying T-37s, T-38s.
Well, it was a huge letdown, if you will, from the T-38.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, I got selected for some special missions, and that, you know, reinvigorated that
mm-hmm.
pride. I think everybody, certainly pilots, because it was so competitive to you know complete the program and even get in the program.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's generally fairly egotistical,
mm-hmm.
and take pride in doing a good job, because you're always trying to meet your peers' expectations. And your peers have pretty high expectations,
mm-hmm.
And so getting selected for those missions, I got to do more things with the aircraft, including. More formation flying,
mm-hmm.
and then you know some of those special weapons delivery, and we prepped to do a mission on the Laotian Trail, the Ho Chi Minh Trail,
right?
Those were all bonding opportunities or pride building opportunities
mm-hmm.
with your crew and. If you were in a multi-aircraft mission with, you know, other crew members, so,
mm-hmm.
Because I used to party with some of my instructors, Kilo in Vietnam. He was a F-4 pilot,
mm-hmm.
and when he was over there, and, John used to rag on me all the time, you know, for being a shoebox driver,
mm-hmm.
and of course I really envied him, you know, strapping on the F-4 and going
mm-hmm.
out, but he used to let us party at their squadron, and they were really good, and they used to, you know, rag on us, but
mm-hmm.
they always were really good to us.
Right.
So, the airplane was enjoyable to fly. It's an outstanding instrument airplane. It's a
mm-hmm.
very reliable airplane.
Mm-hmm.
I suffered combat damage, but always never had any problem getting my airplane back.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fairly forgiving airplane, and it was exciting to fly, certainly for a four-engine transport. It's amazing what you could do with that airplane.
Right. How long did your training at Seward last?
I think that was probably about another 3 months.
Okay. And from there, did you end up going on overseas?
No, I went to Dyess Air Force Base.
Okay.
And while I was at Dyess Air Force Base, I upgraded to aircraft commander.
Okay. And
I take that back. I upgraded when I got to Vietnam because I was at Dyess for just about a year.
Okay.
And while I was there, I went ahead and put in volunteer papers for Vietnam and for fighters repeatedly.
Okay.
I'm still hoping to do that.
When was this at Dyess? Was it 66? Late 66?
Later 66. Mm-hmm. And I wound up going to SOS while I was there. And then from SOS, I went back to the squadron, checked out, and left in the very beginning of 68.
Okay.
And then arrived in country and was there for the... Till I got out.
Mm-hmm.
Till about November of 69.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What did you do at Dyess? What was your job there?
Back to, there you were just a co-pilot.
Okay.
And that's, you had to play with still had all those colonels and majors running around trying to find something to do. And again, I had a good aircraft commander. He was a young captain, and I got my captain's bars while I was there. But he always treated me real well, and then I flew for a lieutenant colonel as his co-pilot, and he was another good guy. We got to go Europe and flew just about everywhere in the States, and it was just exciting time, and all this traveling, and which I, of course, a New York City kid, I'd never been outside New York City. this was pretty fun.
Right. Well, this is in the mid '60s. Tell me what you knew about what the United States was doing in Vietnam and Southeast Asia.
Well, I didn't know much. Honestly, again, I didn't know much. I don't know that I was much of a newspaper reader back then. My dad read the Daily News in New York City, and that was, that's pretty trashy paper. But I mean, that was what working people read back then. There are a couple of other papers just like it, but only my very educated a couple of uncles read things like the New York Times, which is what I read now. But I just didn't. My life was plenty busy, and I had school, and so I didn't read newspapers, and I didn't stay up much on politics. I started to become politically conscious during the Vietnam War, but I don't know that I was very politically conscious in pre-Vietnam, my pre-Vietnam experience. Going to Europe was interesting, meeting Germans. Germans who had been POWs and in America, and it's amazing how much conversation you can have with a non-English speaking person using sign language, some broken English and broken German, and a few beers.
Right.
But I didn't have any big picture of the world. I was pretty ignorant on all those counts.
Did you know why the United States had intervened in the Vietnam conflict?
When I went to SOS at Maxwell, we had briefings, and we actually read counterinsurgency warfare, and we read some things by Mao Zedong, and that started an education process.
Okay.
I was not a reader. I read textbooks. But when I was in college, in my senior year, I had a wonderful opportunity to take a class. You still there?
Yes, I am.
I'm sorry. This phone. Oh, the battery's going down.
Okay.
Well, we'll talk until if it quits, you'll understand why. Okay. Let me go get a different phone
okay.
while we're talking.
Let me pause this.
Anyway,
okay,
so he was a history professor,
mm-hmm.
and he was in a liberal arts school, and of course I was in the engineering school.
Mm-hmm.
But I wound up having, in order to graduate on time, I had to take a class and wound up his class
mm-hmm.
in order to get the credits I needed. And he was a person, as an educator, you'd love this guy. I have since talked to him just in the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
His objective, it was American history, and he said, here's the textbook. We're going to have midterm on the first half, final on the second half.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's what we're going to do in class. So he wasn't even going to talk about the book. That was
right.
up to us to do,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, God, as an engineer, that was frightening.
Mm-hmm.
And what we were going to do in class was read books like The History of Totalitarianism
mm-hmm.
or The Public Philosophy and discuss them. Well, I didn't read books, and I certainly didn't discuss things like The Public Philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, you know, your grade was strictly on the exams. And
okay.
So I decided, well, hell, I'll go to his class, I'll sit in, but I'm not going to participate, and I'm not going to read all those books. I have too many things to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the conversations, and that's the way he conducted it, sitting in the round,
mm-hmm.
we moved all the chairs, and everybody discussed the books. Well, being a talker,
mm-hmm.
I felt really left out.
Right.
And pretty soon, I was reading a book a week along with all the other students on things like the history of totalitarianism
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and participating. And he awakened in me a love for reading. And
okay.
So that, you know, that was my education. It
That's
all
great.
Happened in that one class.
That's great.
So going back to my political awareness.
Yes.
But I was aware of systems, you know, I mean political mm-hmm. systems, but
mm-hmm.
I was not really aware of world politics.
Okay. How about, I mean, had you heard about on the news or just from your...
Well, I knew there was a war going on, and
right.
I was excited to go there and participate, but it was all out of, again, that naivete
mm-hmm.
and self-centered perspective of, you know, getting combat experience and flying
mm-hmm.
in Vietnam. It
mm-hmm.
sounded like, you know, a great thing to do if you want to be an Air Force pilot.
So you put in papers to volunteer to go into the war zone to do this?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
A-7s, F-105s, whatever,
right.
F-100s, whatever they'd let me fly.
Right, right.
But they wouldn't let me fly any of those because I was already in C-130s, which,
mm-hmm.
again, was a critical AFSC.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How did your wife feel about this, that you were applying to go to war?
I couldn't tell her. She would never have understood.
Really?
She understood that, you know, I had a commitment to this patriotism for my country.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, by that time we had a child,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I just was very self-centered at that point in my life, and I just did what I needed to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, after you're in, that dies, and
mm-hmm.
you're putting in the papers, and
right.
how did you find out you were going to go? Did you end up just putting in for 130 work, or did you?
No. My assignment came down just as part of a normal cycle, because I never volunteered to go on a C-130.
Okay.
I thought if I did that, that's exactly what they would do, and I wanted
mm-hmm.
to go in a fighter, so.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But they wouldn't, you know, that they wouldn't let me out of my commitment to 130 training.
Okay. All right.
So it just came as part of the regular cycle, and I got my notification while I was at SOS
okay.
that I had orders to Vietnam.
Okay. How did you feel when you got those orders?
Oh, I was, you know, I was elated.
Okay. And you said you were based where? Not in country, but...
No, we were based in Mactan
mm-hmm.
Air Base in Cebu. No, it's off Cebu. It's on Mactan Island
yes.
in the southern Philippines,
okay.
opposite Cebu.
Okay.
And that was... Richard, there's no way to describe how idyllic that place was. You know, this is a place where every Filipino loved an American.
Really?
He was still Joe. And you could go anywhere, any time of night, anywhere, and people would, hey, Joe, you know. And I had a little motorcycle, and it broke down, and people just came and helped me, you know. I mean,
wow.
you were a special person.
Mm-hmm.
And Filipino culture has an unreasonable reverence for military rank.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were an officer, and so this prestige, I can't tell you the circles that I moved in Manila
mm-hmm.
when I was later on up at Clark,
mm-hmm.
Just because you were a military, U.S. military officer, you know, mm-hmm. guess from the MacArthur era.
Right.
Yeah. So, and I really loved the Filipino people because they were very warm, very kind people, and so artistic.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed the food, and it was just a great experience.
Mm-hmm.
And Mactan was really isolated.
Right. I mean,
so it was just idyllic.
Where did you live at Mactan?
I lived in most of the guys lived in screened-in huts called hooches,
mm-hmm.
and I got some reason I got assigned to room with the base chief of military police,
mm-hmm.
who was a captain, my rank,
mm-hmm.
but I lived with him and the OSI agent, Office of Special Investigation,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and so yeah, I never had to worry about anything.
Right,
I had those guys as roommates, and we lived in what had been Filipino officers' quarters,
mm-hmm.
but they were dormitory style,
mm-hmm.
but private, you know, semi-private rooms.
Right, right, okay. And you said that you were there for a certain amount of time, then you'd go in country for how long?
So you generally fly 2 weeks in country. We did,
okay.
I think we did 16 days.
Okay.
And then you'd come back for 7 to 10 days. And then you'd on those days, you might fly to Japan or some other Asian destination,
mm-hmm.
move stuff around.
Mm-hmm.
Do some training, and you get some, you know, some downtime.
Mm-hmm.
When you're in country, you flew, I believe it was 12 on, 13 off,
okay.
and you rotated around the clock. So you started out with early morning departures, and you wound up flying through the night.
Mm-hmm.
And in the middle of that 16 days, and I believe it was 16 days, you had 48 hours of break. It didn't necessarily be, you know, didn't start it in the morning. It
mm-hmm.
just whenever you came off that rotation, you had 48 hours off, and then you went back to the 12-13, and you kept cycling.
Okay. So, and you would do 16 days, have the 48 hours off, and then you'd go back to the 16 days, or would you go back to Mactan?
No, then you go back to Mactan.
Okay, for 7 to 10.
So you had an insertion day, and so that ate up mm-hmm. one of the 16,
mm-hmm.
and you had an extraction day at the other end that you flew mm-hmm. back to the Philippines, because you took the airplanes back, too, and they did
right.
major maintenance on them, or,
right.
you know, heavier maintenance, as
okay.
they call it. And so the 14 days, you worked 12 of those,
mm-hmm.
and you flew a 12-hour day every day of those 12 days.
Okay. Okay. What kind of things did you haul around when you went back to Mactan, the 7 to 10 days? You said you went to other Asian countries. What kind of things would you transport?
You know, I don't remember. I remember the parts I remember was going to Japan and going shopping and, you know, seeing Japan.
Uh-huh.
At that point, it didn't really matter what was in the back of the airplane. Sometimes it was not much of anything.
Right.
Those were busy work, a lot of them. Sometimes, you know, you moved, I don't know, materiel or you brought something back, but it never seemed anything of any real consequence. In country, I always knew it was in the back of my airplane. It was more important.
Right.
Whether I had munitions back there, or food back there, or
mm-hmm.
people back there,
mm-hmm.
or whatever, you know, Vietnamese army or mm-hmm. prisoners of war, you know,
mm-hmm.
sometimes we haul them too. So, you know, those things I was real keen on knowing what
right.
was going on.
Right, of course. Before we get into talking
yeah.
about Vietnam specifically, tell me what your impressions were of Asia in general and the different countries you went into and the Asian culture, Asian people.
Well, you know, if we include the Philippines,
mm-hmm.
I've talked about that, and the Filipinos were the people I had the most interaction with, and they were wonderful people. You know, you got invited to people's homes. You got invited even to. I had a house girl when eventually, I'll tell you about that when we got to Clark,
mm-hmm.
and so she invited us to her barrio, as they call it, their
mm-hmm.
little village, and you know to. She wanted to show off the officer that she worked for,
right.
but it was a true warm invitation, and I got to, you know, eat with her family and be the like the guest of honor at a wedding when it should have been the bride and groom, you know.
Right.
But so they were wonderful. You know, the Japanese, I didn't spend enough time. They were more, the language barrier was there. I mean, mm-hmm. you could speak English to Filipinos. Mm-hmm. Almost all of them spoke English. But, you know, and I never stayed any of those countries long enough to learn any language. Okinawa was the same way. People were subservient, but very distant.
Mm-hmm.
And polite and gracious, but only in a very formal manner.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in Asian culture, I think that may be reasonably and not pejoratively descriptive of Asian culture.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
Bangkok, I didn't spend enough time there. I had to go back there after I got out.
Mm-hmm.
My wife and I went back there a few years ago.
Okay.
And that's those are great people, but I just didn't have the opportunity to interact with them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're like Filipinos. They're wonderful.
Did you know how long that your duty was going to be overseas? Did they tell you days?
No, I was supposed to be there for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Air Force decided to close MACTAN and turn it back to the Filipino Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And so we moved to Clark.
Mm-hmm.
And so my one-year assignment, I could still go home, or I could bring my wife and child over.
Mm-hmm.
And that really was exciting because, you know, they would have a chance to live in a foreign country.
Mm-hmm.
And living in the Philippines, you can afford a housekeeper and you know, live-in, a babysitter, mm-hmm. cook. It was a pretty heady lifestyle for a young kid from New York, so to speak.
Right.
So I elected, you know, and encouraged my wife to come, and she did.
Okay.
And so then you still did the same thing, but your family was back at Clark now when you came back.
Right. When did you move up to Clark? What do you remember the date? Or roughly the date.
Actually, I do. August or September, it's August of 68.
Okay.
So I spent the rest of 68 and almost all 69 there.
Okay.
And I don't remember how they determined your rotation date, but I had a normal rotation. You know, you got some credit for the part you were unaccompanied, and then mm-hmm. and that's. It's remote, I think. Maybe not remote, but it's an unaccompanied assignment to MACTAN and then accompanied, and they make some adjustment for the time.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, I think Clark would have been otherwise a two-year commitment.
Okay.
So I had about 20 to 22 months there.
Okay. How different was MACTAN from Clark? Or Clark from MACTAN?
Oh, awful. Awful in many respects because it was... You know, it was headquarters, 13th Air Force? And so you had rank there, and you had all the bullshit of, you know, the inspections and, I mean, you know, we were flying in country,
mm-hmm.
and you come back, and you're expected to wait on, if you have to transact business at the personnel office or supply, mm-hmm. you have to wait behind everybody else. And you didn't have the time that everybody else had.
Right.
And they afforded us a chance to go R&R. But everybody had, and you had to sit in line to get, it was not by lottery or by any rotation.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you're flying in Vietnam and nobody does anything to assist the crews that are flying the mission, and the only reason for Clark is to support the mission,
mm-hmm.
but it seemed like base personnel had an edge on everything. You know, they got the best things out of supplies,
mm-hmm.
they always got the new uniforms, the new equipment, because you weren't there to protect yourself, and that I also felt very resentful to our officers, our seniors,
mm-hmm.
for not insisting that the operational troops, I mean, I had to go and fight for my enlisted people to get them stuff that they needed when that should have all been done for them.
Right.
You know, so that was discouraging.
This is more of what we were talking about earlier, the Air Force bureaucracy.
Bureaucracy, right. And boy, you know, they had a big bureaucracy at Clark because it was a headquarters base.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you always had to defer to honestly, all the trivial stuff,
mm-hmm.
when to me everything should have been on the mission of making the combat crews have everything they needed, and the airplanes get, you know, the very best attention,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, mm-hmm. the general's airplane was still the one that was shiniest, and
right.
And I understand that that's, you know, the way the world works, but it just was disappointing that, you know, guys that were being asked to go over there and be, you know, and, you know, we weren't like fighter pilots. We certainly weren't like the poor guys on the ground that were getting shot at all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But we did get shot at, and we did, you know, we did do without a lot. We worked hard as hell, and nobody was helping us, and that felt frustrating. I never felt like my superiors were supporting us the way they should have. They should have insisted. I mean, I can't describe some of the awful food we ate in Vietnam, and I didn't understand that. That was not necessary.
Mm-hmm.
The Navy didn't eat like that, but, you know, that's another thing about, you know, the Air Force. So.
Mm-hmm.
And sometime we should talk about what it was like for the spouses, because
Well, why don't you go ahead and tell me? What?
Well, I remember right after I went to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and... we were there at Quezon, and, you know, mail was absolutely the lifeline. I mean, it's just like for the young people over there now, the soldiers and sailors and airmen,
mm-hmm.
to be able to communicate with their families. So they do email. We just did mail, surface snail mail.
Right.
But the Air Force or the military did get priority, and all our mail went back and forth without postage, and or at least from us it went without postage, and it went air mail. So... there's nothing like getting a letter. I can't tell you. It didn't matter what it said. Didn't have to say anything.
Mm-hmm.
And if it had a picture in it, that was just incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so that you maintained a connection with those who you cared about.
Mm-hmm.
And for the spouses, when I, like my case, I went over there, and so they knew I was up doing stuff at Quezon. And my wife is watching, she's with her brother and his children. They're watching news,
mm-hmm.
and they show us. It wasn't a C-130, it was a C-7, which is the Caribou,
mm-hmm.
And they show it getting shot down over a caisson.
Mm.
And the kids, of course, they're little kids. They jump up and down. Aunt Tessie, it's Uncle Tony. And
right.
She comes running in, and they play it again or something. I don't
right.
know. You know, and you know, for her, it was just devastating,
right?
And I think, of course, for the American public, that reporting, they always say, bringing the war right into the living room,
mm-hmm.
really was very hard on the spouses.
Mm-hmm.
And at Clark Air Base, they would dispense Valium like you might think you'd dispense aspirin.
Really?
Oh. Awful. And,
to the spouses.
To the spouses. And, of course, there's encouragement for social life at the club. So people, including my spouse, and I'm not married to her anymore, and that's sad, but that's, you know, that was part of the strain of it all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think some of this happened to the POW wives. You know, they started drinking at the club.
Mm-hmm.
They were popping Valiums. And they were doing this as a group, so there was, you know, all this group support for this sort of behavior.
Right.
And, of course, there was lots of marital infidelity going on,
mm-hmm.
Just because of the stress.
Mm-hmm.
Guys were doing that in country, and wives were doing it back at the base, because there's always
mm-hmm.
transients coming through. And
mm-hmm.
So... You know, it was terribly stressful for the families because, while we never lost a crew in my squadron, but we lost a crew in the sister squadron.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't like the fighter pilots. I mean, that they tend to, you know, take a higher toll,
mm-hmm.
and they certainly had the POWs. You know, it was only later in the war that the B-52 pilot crews got captured. I think it was still very hard on, you know, there was this disconnect between your family was, your husband which at that time it was all husbands, were in country, and you were back here at Clark, and there was all this partying and liveliness. And, of course, the wing people and the base support people, they were all there in, as, you know, couples and partying and stuff. And, you know, it's, so why, you know, why is my husband over there? I think all those questions, it was just very hard on the spouses.
Right. Okay. Well, tell me what your first impressions were of Vietnam when you first flew in.
It's going to be hard to separate to just the first impressions. You know, it was,
or general impressions.
Yeah, it's an enchanting country, topography, coastline. It's beautiful. It's harsh, and. And the first time, you know, because I got there right after Tet, and all that was still going on, they were still, you know, the battles were still going on at Hue, and we were still supporting the Marines at Khe Sanh.
So you first flew in country in early February 68?
I believe that's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. It was just right after Tet, and we were at Tansanute at that point.
Okay.
So you know, went down and eventually got to actually see the city go from the Pearl of the Orient to this place with concertina wire everywhere, armed. You know, before that, I guess it was a pretty. Gay lifestyle in many respects, but then they, you know, then they started doing the bombings of the restaurants and things like that, and everything started to change. And although we were not supposed to have a private weapon, nobody checked back then. You know, it's not like airline security today. So I had two weapons that I took with me over there, because I mean that's another thing. The Air Force would send us out on a combat mission. And here we are landing at on a piece of road, which I did several times. And you don't know who's in the trees, and you have a P-38. Now give me a break.
Gosh.
What the hell are you going to do with it? So, you know, not a magazine with the aircraft commander having the key that you unlock when you go out to the airplane, of M-16s, but a P-38, not even a 45 caliber. And, I mean, so it was such a joke. So before I left, I had a friend who had been an air commando in a SOS, and he took me down to a gun store, and I bought a Browning combat side piece that held 13 rounds, because I wanted the, you know, maximum number I could have with me in the gun, and then an extra clip. And then I bought a 25 caliber Beretta, which I could carry. You didn't go into Saigon in uniform because you didn't want anybody to know you were a pilot. Okay?
Right.
I mean, that was just good street smarts. And so you always went in civilian clothes. And so I had this little 25 caliber Beretta with a little belt holster that I can tuck into my pants and drape my shirt over. And so I figured I'm not gonna fend off an attack, but at least I was going to let somebody know that they, if they were coming at me, that I could shoot back. And
that's interesting. You felt that vulnerable in Saigon.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because of those restaurant bombings and because I had this air commando friend, you know, he told me. Well, and by that time, I had already lost one of my classmates who was an air commando. He was on, I guess they were B-26s. Yeah, that's right. He was on a B-26, and they got shot down. And then... one of our instructors was already a POW, F-105. So, you know, you started to get a sense that this was for real. Anyway, and Saigon, you just had to be careful. And that's just, you know, just what it was.
What were your impressions of Saigon?
Oh, you know, a big city. Some of the things I share with my wife, Joy, that always impressed me was how the women, who are incredibly thin, I mean, it always seemed like you could grab them around the waist with your hand, they would walk with such poise in these O-dyes, which mm-hmm. is a split pants and the skirt,
mm-hmm.
The split skirt and the pants under the,
mm-hmm.
And they would glide through the streets which had mud and garbage on them and everything else, and they would be completely oblivious of the smells, the sights,
mm-hmm.
and they would just, that's one sight. The other was just the destruction, the lack of public sanitation, just
mm-hmm.
because it was a city under duress.
Right.
The teeming hordes of bicycles and little motorcycles, scooter type things,
mm-hmm.
and the people trying to live their life,
mm-hmm.
while you're there for this war, and they're there trying to live their life and
mm-hmm.
run shops and go about their daily business, and
mm-hmm.
that awareness develops as I got to spend time in some of the small hamlets, and I'll tell you about that at some point.
Okay, why don't you go ahead, sir?
Okay, I don't get to talk about Vietnam much anymore, and you ask such probing questions. It's interesting to hear what I have to say myself.
Okay.
So Saigon was, you could see the beautiful architecture, and you could get a sense of the what it must have been like. I just finished reading The Quiet American. Have you read that yet?
Yes, I have.
Okay, that's a really poignant book, and I think mm-hmm. it's poignant for the current situation as well.
Yes, sir.
Really, really telling. You used to go to the Continental Hotel and have a coffee, but,
mm-hmm.
it had to be done with more watchfulness, perhaps, than they used to do. Used to go to the top of some of the hotels, like the Majestic, which was turned into an officer's quarters now. When I went back to Vietnam with my wife a couple of years ago,
mm-hmm.
we actually had breakfast. It's now a 4-star hotel.
Mm-hmm.
We had breakfast up on the same roof that we used to party up at.
Oh, yeah?
And you'd be partying up there, having cocktails, and somebody would be grilling steaks or something,
mm-hmm.
and you'd be watching the flares drop, and there'd be a firefight going on,
right.
Nothing. So it was all those disconnects,
mm-hmm.
and then it was some of the disconcerting things was watching the black marketeers.
Mm-hmm.
You had to really work to get sometimes some of your ration of uniform, your combat boots, because back there, over there they allowed us to wear essentially camouflage. You didn't have to wear a regular flight suit,
mm-hmm.
and of course you wore all that blacked out black insignia so that it was not so visible, and you wore combat boots rather than what the Air Force used to issue as regular black flight boots,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes they didn't have any in supply, but you could go down in Saigon and you could buy it on the street, and you could see military tools. I still have in my possession a small set of jeweler's files that I bought on the street. Well, I know those were probably military issues.
Mm-hmm.
I should have probably never bought them, but I did.
Mm-hmm.
And then this other disconnect, Richard, you'd go into the BX,
mm-hmm.
and guys that were already rotating back to the States would order in Vietnam. Now,
mm-hmm.
we're not talking about even the Philippines. In Vietnam, you could order a brand new, which one of my co-pilots did, an XKE to be delivered in the States.
Really?
Yeah. And you just give them a delivery time.
Hmm.
And so here you are fighting this, you're there to fight a war,
mm-hmm.
and everybody's in the land of the big BX.
Mm-hmm.
You would see Koreans especially. They were the rocks,
mm-hmm.
Republic of Korea. They had a fierce reputation,
mm-hmm.
Good troops to be on their base when there was an attack.
Mm-hmm.
They never took any prisoners. They were just, really fierce,
mm-hmm.
ruthless guys. And you'd see them come out of the BX carrying televisions. And, you used to go to an air-conditioned movie or the air-conditioned officers club and watch a USO show and then go out and fly a combat mission up to the DMZ.
Right.
It was... All these disconnects were sort of odd on the psyche.
Mm-hmm. How did you deal with that?
I just participated.
Mm-hmm.
I did what we did. You made the best of it. You'd come back from you'd fly all night. You'd come in the morning. You go to the officers' club. You'd have a Bloody Mary and a big breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
Then you go to the air-conditioned movie. Mm-hmm. Just watch, didn't matter what was showing, and just watch the movie to be in the air conditioning. And then as an air crew, we did get air conditioned quarters most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you had to sleep in the middle of the day, the heat of the day. And then you go back to your room and you sleep so you can get up and eat and go fly.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know...
That was your typical day.
That was often the day. I mean, some days, you know, because sometimes you flew during the night and you had to sleep during the day, and other times it was
mm-hmm.
more normal.
Right.
So sometimes you'd go down, and then when you had your 48 hours, you could go down in Saigon, and we'd generally go as, at least the officers would go, and we'd go together and have lunch or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or you know, you had to choose the places more carefully for security reasons and that sort of thing. And, you know, and of course some guys went for the flesh bars that,
mm-hmm.
and what is the name of that street, you know, some of the guys that may have mentioned it, Tudor Street or something, where they had all the
mm-hmm.
all the bars and stuff.
We
didn't hang there. I do say, honestly, I think a lot of the enlisted guys spent a lot of time there.
Right.
But they had a Vietnamese officers club on the base that offered a full service, you know, facility, if you get my gist. And,
uh-huh.
Yeah, and you know,
a Vietnamese officer.
Well, but you could go there as a,
okay.
a you know, as a white, as an American, and they were happy to have you there. They had their, you know, the girls there with the silicone implanted breasts, and
uh-huh.
and they, like I said, they offered any service you wanted.
This was on base.
On base. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it was on the Vietnamese jurisdiction, not you know, U.S. government.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Tell me about. Go ahead.
No, I don't know if there was anything else.
Well, I'm interested. I mean, you're describing Saigon. Did you have particular restaurants where you always frequented, or particular bars where you frequented?
No, I didn't. We didn't go to too many bars because you know that if we did any drinking, it was usually.
Mm-hmm.
Back at the base, or it was because it was really cheap and it was safe.
Right.
But sometimes you go to lunch. You know, I had a pair of shoes made while I was there, and
mm-hmm.
you know, they're custom made and a tailor. So you know, sometimes I do that, and sometimes just to see some of the sights. It was, you know,
mm-hmm.
that's the start of the influx of the refugees, and it was really apparent how Saigon was changing. I mean, there were people trying to live everywhere
mm-hmm.
as they fled from the countryside into the city.
Right.
And, you know, we didn't... It took a good bit of effort to go into Saigon proper. So most times we didn't go in there. You could do things at the base. We had, a music library where you could go and make... of course, it was reel-to-reel back then. You'd
mm-hmm.
make reel-to-reel recordings of... I record a lot of classical music while
mm-hmm.
I was there. I still have them. Of course, nobody plays reel-to-reel anymore.
Right.
Right. But, you know, did things like that,
uh-huh.
and would go to the library and did a lot of reading.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and a good bit of hanging out at the club or just,
mm-hmm.
you know, you only had so much time because you really needed to feed yourself and rest because, you know, you had 12 hours. And you had to do all of that, and so it was mostly on the 48 hours that you
mm-hmm.
did any sort of the visiting in town. And
right.
That sort of thing.
Do you remember how much you'd pay for a pair of boots on the black market?
Well, no, I didn't buy boots on the black
okay.
market, but if they were military issue,
mm-hmm.
they could have been, you know, $2 or $3 to $5. I don't think any
okay.
more than that.
Okay.
Yeah. What I was talking about was having actually a custom pair of beautiful grain leather loafers made.
Right, right. Do you remember the books that you read? You said you did a lot of reading there. What were you into at that point?
You know, that's a long time ago, and I really don't remember.
Right.
I'll try to leave that percolate maybe tomorrow
okay.
or something. I can
okay.
dredge up some answers for that.
Okay.
But I was reading a pretty broad array. I used to read Playboy magazine with a dictionary because
really?
As an engineer, I wanted, from that experience with Professor Cannon, I really wanted to expand my language skills
mm-hmm.
and so forth. So, you know, of course, I looked at the photographs,
mm-hmm.
But I was really interested in reading. They used to, I mean, Hefner used to publish a lot of good authors back then, and so they were interesting articles, and they were articles about subjects I wouldn't normally have otherwise been exposed to, I mean, they were political, they were social commentary, they were humor, they were psychology, and so, you know, I mean, more layman psychology, of course, but I enjoyed that exposure, and the level of English language use was better than, you know, popular science or the other things I would have normally have been reading in my earlier life. So I read that, and I used to read it with the dictionary, so, you know, I could increase my vocabulary.
Did the guys rip you and say, hey, Bora, what are you doing reading Playboy with the dictionary?
I'm sure some of them did. I don't remember. Yeah, you know, I probably didn't do it in the ready room or something like that.
But
we always took a book with us because, you know, again, at least the three officers on the crew, the co-pilot, the AC, and the navigator, we'd all have college, and there weren't many that you know, there were some like Korean and older guys era that didn't have to have college to get commissioned. Anyway, so there was always books to exchange and talk about, and when we landed someplace, like say on the road somewhere where you stay vigilant and in the cockpit, but say if you went from Saigon to to Cameron Bay or Da Nang, well, while you're there, they have to offload the airplane and onload the airplane and fuel the airplane, and so there's time, and sometimes we just go underneath the airplane where it was cool, or if it's at night, you'd find some place with some light, and read. You know, sometimes you would just visit, but there was time for that. And later on, we moved from Tonsonut up to Cameron Bay, and so you had you're right there on the water, and so on your off time, often go down the beach and just read and, you know, sun and whatever. So
how much time on average would you say that you would have when you would, I guess it would depend on your cargo, but when you would land and offload and kind of wait?
I'd say probably anywhere from 30 to 40 minutes.
Okay.
Not any. This was when you're on a safe base.
Right.
Yeah.
Of course.
Right. Because the other places you're trying to, oftentimes you only unload and you try to, scoot things out as fast as possible.
What was Tonsonut like?
That was headquarters MACV. So at the club you saw some rank. Those guys generally socialized, I think, in a different area than we did, all the staff guys. Where I was mostly air crew. But, you know, it had full range of activity. I mean, there were a variety of mess halls you could eat in besides the O Club, and some of them, occasionally you'd run across a sergeant that really, there was one in particular, took real pride in his mess hall, and you'd contribute 10 cents with your meal towards a condiment fund, and he would have bottled salad dressings, and he'd have spaghetti night, and you'd get a free can of beer. And of course, liquor was incredibly inexpensive. I think a 24-can case of beer mostly cost about $2.10, believe it or not.
Wow.
Yeah, so, I mean, okay. And then he'd have spaghetti night. I'm sorry, he'd serve steak with beer. He'd serve pasta with wine. You know, he had seat backs made for all the chairs that had squadron logos on them. He was obviously a guy that had just tremendous pride, and what a delight to eat in his mess hall. And then there were others where, you know, the food was just atrocious. And,
such as?
Oh, you know what chipped beef on toast is?
I can only imagine.
Okay. Well, I mean, in the military, they often call it SOS, for, you know, shit on a single.
Yes.
Okay. Well, this place would make it where they had put so little effort into it. First of all, it looked like gruel. I don't think they use milk. And and then the when you put your fork into it, you'd hit dry pockets of flour that would just pop open and puff.
Mm.
And so you imagine what that tasted like in your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they spooned the... I learned you don't never blame the clerk. You blame the manager. So we had Vietnamese that worked on the serving line. And somebody's got to teach them and insist that they do certain things. Well,
mm-hmm.
if you don't do that, they're just going to do whatever is easiest. And they'll spend most of their time talking to one another.
Right.
So you get really poor service. And then they would ladle the pancake syrup over the pancakes, your eggs and potatoes.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it was just, I mean, sometimes you just want to scream,
mm-hmm.
but nobody cared, you know. And
mm-hmm.
that's why I said I was disappointed that the officers, seniors, didn't ever, mm-hmm. they never ate with us. They never looked at that, and you complained about it, and they never did anything about it.
Right, right.
And I had to get my crew during the middle, when we flew those night missions, you had to find some nourishment for them.
Right.
And it was strictly up to you. I mean, they didn't make any effort to help us get crew meals.
They didn't have a night mess hall?
No.
Okay.
They had a flight line place,
mm-hmm.
and I can't tell you how despicable the grease of what they served out of there was. And sometimes that's all there was. And
mm-hmm.
when you went out, like say, I remember being at Quinan
mm-hmm.
on the coast, at every base, you eventually found, we all shared information. Yeah, we always found out where there was some place where you could get food for your crew.
Okay.
But we all had to do that. Nobody ever set up a system for that.
Hmm.
Because they were, most of the officers stayed back in Clark, and they only came in country. What the despicable thing they would do, along with what we call the wing weenies,
mm-hmm.
was they would fly in the last day of the month on an insertion mission,
mm-hmm.
and then leave on that same airplane, or the other airplane going back as the extraction mission, on the next day, and they would get combat pay for the 2 months,
mm.
and that was their contribution to the war. Now
right.
I understand some of those guys were, they. Not by choice, they were working at the wing, and some of those guys were doing good jobs.
Mm-hmm.
But you saw a lot of people who you knew were just hanging out back there, avoiding coming over, and
mm-hmm.
And they got the same combat pay you did, and they got the same credit for a tour, and
mm-hmm.
that was disheartening.
How much resentment was there?
GIs always love to gripe.
mm-hmm.
I'm sure we did our share of that, but
mm-hmm.
you certainly couldn't dwell there.
Right.
You had the camaraderie so that you just looked at them with disdain, and you knew you and your buddies were doing,
mm-hmm.
The job, and you took, pride in that.
Right, right. Sir, why don't we go and take a break for the day?
Yeah, I think I was just going to ask you the same thing.
Okay.
That'd be great.
Okay, we'll pick up tomorrow.
You're